The hour of 1 o'clock p.m. having arrived, I will call the Minture Legislative Oversight Committee to order when we have a quorum. We're not quite there yet, but we will start with testimony. As you can see from your agenda, we have some committee business to go over quickly, and we will do that. I think we do have a quorum. I'll officially call. Oh, okay. Representative Murphy, are you with us? Representative Murphy? Representative Murphy will be joining us shortly on the phone here. So I'll officially call the Minture Legislative Oversight Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum. We'll go through some committee business. If anyone's had a chance, Senator Hayden, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I moved the minutes of the last meeting.
Senator Hayden moved the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And members, if you could get your sheets in, Senator Lori and I will be signing those for today's meeting. Before we get into testimony, is there any other business that needs to come before the committee at this point? Okay, let's get started. You'll see number three, a discussion of 2016 individual market and small group rates, the Department of Commerce. If the Department of Commerce could please join us at the front table here. Is there anyone here from the Department of Commerce? Anyone from the Department of Commerce? Okay, if it's okay with members, we'll go to item four at this point, and we will backfill then with the Department of Commerce after the discussion of experience with Minture and expectations for upcoming enrollment period. We've invited county workers, the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, and Minnesota Council of Health Plans to join us. So we can maybe take those in three different groups here. Is there anyone here from the county workers that would like to make a presentation? Okay, if you could please join us. And welcome to the Minture Legislative Oversight Committee. If you could please state your names for the record and who you represent.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Marty Fishbach, and I am the Director of Employment and Economic Assistance in Dakota County.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Deborah Huskins. I'm an Area Director with the Human Services and Public Health Department in Hennepin County.
How do you spell your last name?
Huskins.
Thank you very much. And Hennepin County?
Pardon me? Hennepin.
Yes. Hennepin County. Please proceed.
Thank you. Since the rollout of Minsure, it's been a difficult journey. We are starting to see some needed improvements, but we're still very much in an implementation stage. System functionality that started out to be very limited has improved. We can't do everything, but we can do much more in the system. The volume of cases exceeded projections for counties. We've had a couple years now to right-size our staffing and workflow models, but it continues to be difficult because new work processes that are released are more time-consuming when they're first released than when it becomes a regular part of your everyday work. Renewals are a good example of this, and I will talk a little bit more about renewals in a little bit. But right now I'll just highlight that the issue is that you have to tackle a backlog before you do the regular work. So some of the we're going to go over some themes that counties are experiencing. The first one is, I alluded to, is system functionality, and there's a range of functionality issues. Some functionality exists, but it has yet to be released. Some functionality has been implemented, but it needs to be fixed. Some functionality does not exist, and needs to be created. And there is existing functionality where we need a streamlined process. So those are kind of the functionality buckets that we have concerns in. Here are some examples of improvements and some functionality examples in each of these categories. So in the yet-to-be-released category, there's a supervisor workspace that exists, but it hasn't been rolled out yet. And this will be helpful when it's rolled out to manage units and track worker production. Another example of something yet to be released is we can't see an online application entered through the citizen portal in the worker portal. So, for example, if someone said, you know, I don't know if I answered this question correctly, we wouldn't be able to look at the application and confirm or deny that. We could also use some additional reporting functionality that hasn't been customized and released. So reporting is something that would just help us manage caseloads and manage the workload. And we could use more robust functionality with managing tasks, like moving tasks. So these are like a work list of things to do. Moving tasks, assigning tasks, access to cover tasks for an absent worker, sorting tasks to be able to prioritize work more easily, that kind of thing. In the area of needs to be fixed, we have notification letters to participants that work for the most part, but they could use improvement. We can see most notices, but every so often there's a piece where we can't see a notice. So these are this is notices that are going out to the customers to inform them of the status of their case or what they need to do next. There is a project team working on this. We are aware of that. Another issue that needs to be fixed is we're seeing duplication in cases. These aren't always caught. In the area of functionality that does not exist, we have a needed interface with our child support system so that referrals are made for medical assistance cases. And this, again, is another one of those things that are on a docket for the future. Existing functionality needing to be streamlined is kind of another functionality bucket. We have some good news in this area. We've recently seen the addition of streamlined life event procedures, and these were formerly known as wizards. They have significantly reduced the time to enter information. So, for example, you might have heard that adding a baby takes about 45 minutes, and with the wizard, you can do it in about 10 to 15 minutes. In addition to adding a household member, there are two other streamlined life event procedures, and we're looking forward to getting more to help alleviate time-consuming procedures. The other theme I wanted to just talk about is renewals. Renewals are cases that need an annual eligibility determination to assess that they are still eligible for medical assistance or the program that they are on. Counties have been involved in recent months in developing the detailed processes on renewals. This has been very helpful because counties have brought practical, detailed questions and experience to the table, so solutions could be devised and instructions written very quickly. So the renewal, where we're at with renewals is in August, the renewal procedures were released for the first time and we completed January through May. So ideally you would have completed January in January, but instead we were doing January through May in August. And this is what I was kind of referring to earlier as when you first get a procedure rolled out, you're dealing with a backlog before you actually get to do business as usual. So in September we worked on renewals for June through August. Currently in October, we're working on September and October cases. And eventually we'll get to the place where we will be working in advance of in the month. So by in early 2016 is when we expect that to happen. Participants will be notified of the renewals 45 days before the month they're renewed. So, for example, February renewals will be sent to the participants in mid-December. So those are a couple of themes, and I'm going to hand it over to Deb to talk about a couple more.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty. So the theme that I want to talk about first is county engagement and involvement with the state on helping to improve the system and the procedures. Over the last 2 years, counties have been involved more and more in actually becoming part of an integral part of the planning and implementation of the MNSHR system and the procedures that are required for MNSHR. We have a whole variety of different ways in which counties are involved. We have county line staff who are involved in some of the projects to improve the system, and they're helping to write the procedures, identify what's needed at a very, very detailed, particular, specific level. And they're the ones with the expertise. They work in the system every day, and it's important that their voice is there. There are also a number of counties who have given to the state mobility workers, people who can be at the state half-time or even more sometimes to help solve some of the issues and the daily work that's going on, but also be involved in the projects to improve the system. We also have a biweekly management level committee that has been going on for over 2 years that meets with both Minute and DHS staff to provide input, feedback, consultation, et cetera. And that is ongoing. And we also have a subgroup of eight members, county members, who meet with the leadership of the state, MNSHR and Minute and DHS staff, biweekly, and we have a very open conversation about what's going on, what are the questions, what are the issues, what needs to be handled next. We also have counties a seat on the governance structure on the executive steering committee for the system, and I'm the one who occupies that county role at this time. Another big challenge in relation to that, however, is two-way communication with county staff at all levels throughout the state. There are a lot of counties that don't have the capability of staying as attuned to MNSHR issues as some of the rest of us are, and so we're trying to increase our ability to effectively communicate with them, keep them up to speed without having to require a lot of their resources at the same time. One of the things I want to mention in the area of communication is an issue that has been resolved and has really helped a lot. One of the things that counties had been experiencing for the first probably year and a half of MNSHR operations was when a case, when a person or an individual or a family came to the county and was in a crisis, needed to that situation to be resolved right away, and they couldn't, the county worker didn't have all the tools to be able to do that. And sometimes it would involve a systems issue, a policy issue, and a MNSHR eligibility issue. And it was very difficult to get those situations resolved. And the county workers felt awful having somebody needing help and not being able to do anything about it. So we brought that feedback to the state, and the state has implemented something which they did call like a 911 type call. It's now an urgent case resolution system, and it is working very well. That's been in place for a number of months now, and cases are getting resolved, if not right on the phone at the time, within a day or two. And so that's been a huge help, not only to our customers, but our county workers as well. The other thing I want to talk about is planning for 2016. 2016 is coming up really fast, as we all know, and the counties are very involved in helping to identify the priorities for system improvement in 2016. We did have an active role in the 2015 priority setting, and that that process has been renewed. We are in the process of looking over our input to the state as the state is working on its priorities and its planning for 2016. We've been assured that county needs and concerns will be a key part of the planning and prioritization, and we're currently working on this list of high priority needs that we'll be submitting to the state in a few days. Some of the themes that are coming up as we gather that input is we need better notices to customers. I think Marty mentioned notices earlier. If the notices are clear, they can help resolve questions, or the county workers can help understand what's going on and resolve the issues more quickly. Another theme is reports for managing cases, especially in counties where there's very, very many cases, and some of us, especially Hennepin and Dakota, have a lot of cases. We need data. We need to be able to look at reports and be able to move tasks around, move work to different staff, and figure out different ways to get the work done most efficiently, and the reports can help for that. Also, there are some specific areas that cause problems for some counties, especially in identification numbers is one that we're working with the state on. So we'll be giving that input shortly. Finally, I want to mention systems modernization. MNSHR to the counties is not just a MNSHR system for healthcare eligibility, as important as that is. This is our first opportunity to really see how we can improve human services delivery of government programs in the future. It's our first major step towards improving our computer systems, replacing the legacy systems that we are still laboring with. We are able to see our first glimpse into the future. For example, people going onto the system and entering their own application and, in many cases, getting all the way through to eligibility and enrollment determination without any worker help needed. And that's really where the whole nation is going in terms of better services to people who need our help. So having a system that allows people to apply online and get what they need by themselves is a big leap forward, and we do see that as the precursor of where we want to go with all of the rest of our programs. As the citizen portal improves over time and people are able to check the status of their cases and enter their own changes, that's not in place at this point, but is intended to be in place at some time, that'll be a big benefit for consumers and for county workers alike. We do think that this technology knowledge that's being learned through MNsure and the capabilities that are being developed can be leveraged to modernize our other public assistance programs, including our cash assistance, SNAP or food assistance, child support, and also social services into the future. So we're looking forward to those other enhancements. Bottom line is counties need a modern system with the ability of workers in new generations and consumers to be able to apply, review cases, make changes systematically, and do all of that online. For customers who've been able to do that, we see a huge benefit for those customers and for the counties. But the counties need system functionality at a level where we can address the needs of our consumers in a timely manner. Bottom line is we need a viable system. We are seeing some progress in the system that the MNsure system that we have at this time, and we're hopeful that that will continue and get even better. Through our Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, we have a strong position that the healthcare IT system needs to be able to integrate with our business areas. So, for example, healthcare. We often see families who need health care, but they also need food support or housing or some mental health support. We need to be able to integrate all of those so that we can serve our customers more effectively and help them to improve their lives. That's the end of my testimony. If you have any questions for us, we'd
Thank you, Ms. Hoskins. Questions for members? Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologize, this might have been covered. I stepped out just for a second. What percentage, and I'm glad to hear you say that MNsure is making progress and working with the counties, and maybe this was covered, but what percentage of the applications that you send, that the counties send in, are still on paper?
Ms. Hoskins?
Deborah Hoskins from Hennepin County, Mr. Chair and Representative. I can't give you the percentage, but I can give you an idea. We have about 140,000 MA cases in Hennepin County, and a little over 60,000 of those are on the MNsure system. So it's a little bit less than half of our MA cases are on the MNsure system at this time. And we have most of the applications that go through, I hesitate to say that it's half that go through without any trouble. I don't know, Marty, if you have any better insight into that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, with regards to paper applications, we did a kind of a hand count, I guess I would say, and we found that about half of the applications were paper and half were going on online, and about half of the online actually went through seamlessly, and the other half needed some additional verifications or something confirmed.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question, and I don't know that there's a good answer to this, but that's the kind of questions I like. From a county perspective, I think, Ms. Hoskins, you mentioned something about annual renewals. Mm-hmm. What part does the county play in determining whether or not somebody's going to continue to be eligible for the plan they're on, eligible for MNsure, going to get a tax credit? To what extent is the county involved in that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the county does not actually determine whether somebody is eligible or what plan they're eligible for or whether they are eligible for a tax credit, for example. It's the system and the rules that are built into the system that helps do that.
Just checking. Thank you.
Person Popper.
Senator Lerner.
Maybe a little bit of a follow-up to the first question about the statistics. Does it depend on what type of eligibility an individual has for Medicaid in terms of whether they're on paper or whether they're through the system, like the MAGI population is a little different than the disabled population, little aged, blind, disabled entrance point? And then also, how do those numbers compare to 2014, 2015? Are we making substantial progress? And then for those that are still needing a little bit of, you know, that aren't going perfectly smoothly, is the time that it takes to do whatever it whatever is needed to move that case along, is that time improving?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'll try to remember all your questions. Firstly, the people who are eligible to go on to the MNsure system right now are the MAGI, not the elderly or disabled. So those wouldn't come through this door at all. And the time that it is taking, the people who apply, we encourage everybody to apply online if possible, and I think all counties are in agreement that that's by far the best. If the application can be done online and it goes through, eligibility is determined almost immediately, and nobody has to touch it. It goes very, very well. So we really, and especially in Hennepin County, but I think all counties are really encouraging people to try it online. We're still getting about 300 applications in paper per week, but we try to encourage even those people to apply online. So it does go very well in many cases. There are things, as Marty was outlining, there are a lot of things that are going better that we can do. Some of them, for example, with the Wizards, adding a newborn or adding a household member, adding coverage for somebody, those things go much more effectively now than they did a number of months ago. And at least in Hennepin County, our MA caseload is way up from earlier years, especially before 2013. It's been going up quite a bit the last 2 years, and our uninsurance rate is quite low compared to previous years.
Marty, do you wanna... Senator Lurie?
Excuse
me, Senator Lurie. Did Ms. Fishbach want to respond to that? Or?
No, I don't have any additional.
Sorry, Senator Lurie.
Just a real brief. So then it's not so much what it's mostly the MAGI population that you were giving us the information about who's done electronically and who's done on paper, but what I guess I heard was that it's more about the individual applying and their decision to do it on paper rather than online. That's really the piece that you're working on, to do some computer literacy maybe and try to help encourage people to choose the online option, because that's less work, but it's really still at the option. And there is supposed to be, I mean, the ACA does provide for no wrong door. Mm-hmm. You still have to support paper applications if that's what the consumer chooses. I'm assuming that's sort of the issue between the online versus paper. Is that
Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's accurate. Most of the time it's people that it's just preference, or maybe they struggled with an online application at some point, and so they go to paper. But the online application process has improved quite a bit, so people even that maybe were frustrated in the very beginning might have success now. So we still encourage online.
Senator Lurie. Okay, and just an announcement to members here. We have Representative Murphy E. is with us on the phone here. Is that correct, Representative Murphy E.? I'm so wonderful, I can hardly believe it. Representative Murphy, anytime you have a question, just John Reynolds is by the microphone here, so we'll get you in the queue with any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions for the counties. I'm wondering, you know, in terms of workload and how the system's working, what percentage of the way, in terms of kind of our ultimate goal, would you say MNsure is in terms of it being a self-service portal for consumers and the people trying to get on public programs, and versus a kind of still a full-service model being done by the counties? If you were to kind of give a spectrum of where we're at in that, is there a kind of an idea that you could give us in terms of the burden? I know we've made some progress from, you know, 2 years ago. I've been to the counties a couple times and in touch and know that there has been some progress, but that the burden is still very real, and I'm just wondering for an idea of that.
Who would like that one? Ms. Hoskins?
I'll take a stab at it.
All right.
And then you can join in. Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, it's for the individual consumer who's applying, I would say that it's certainly still less than 50%, but I think there are improvements that are coming on, and there are other people here who could testify more fully, I think, to the consumer experience. I think for counties, we're still a few years away from a fully functional system that's up to speed with what we would like it to be.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, you know, you talked about the wizards a little bit and some of the help that they have put in place for some of the processing. My understanding is, how do those times still compare to what it took to process a new life event? Even with the wizards now, how does that compare to how it was before MNsure was implemented?
Ms. Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are still a little bit longer than what we were doing in the legacy system. So in the add-a-baby example, in the legacy system, we were adding, it took about 5 minutes. In the new system before the wizards, it was about 45 minutes. With the wizard, it's down to about 10 to 15 minutes. And the wizards are still relatively new, so what I don't know is if there'll be some efficiencies with people just learning the processes better.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if you could shed some light on what you see as, you know, still the biggest obstacles to faster processing of those paper applications, and kind of a tie-in question with that. I understand that DHS has a helpline for county workers, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering how that works. I've heard various anecdotal stories that raise some concerns about that and what that means for county workers, but if you could just speak to that kind of firsthand, what that looks like and what that helpline offers county workers as they're dealing with some of these challenges still with paper applications.
Ms. Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll take your second question. The emergency line that we've set up has actually worked amazingly well. Prior to having that line, they weren't issues that would come up weren't necessarily prioritized. You have somebody who wasn't having a medical need that just needed a fix in their case, but they didn't have a medical need. And then you had people with a serious medical need that needed attention now, and they were all being put in the same queue. And now we can call and say, this person's, you know, in the hospital and has this need, and it can be resolved many times in the same day, sometimes in a couple of days, but usually works out really well. So that piece is working really well. And then would you be willing to repeat your first question?
Representative Mack.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was, what are some of, if you could articulate some of the biggest obstacles to the processing of the paper applications still, if you could kind of have a wish list of this is what would make that so much easier with those paper applications, what are those outstanding things?
Sure.
Ms. Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm thinking about processing in general, not necessarily a paper application, because I think you can have some of the same things that need to be resolved on a case from an electronic application and a paper application. But one of the things that we've found right now is that we're working pretty reactively. So we will respond to things we get in the mail. We'll respond to phone calls. We'll make changes on those cases. What we're not doing effectively right now is we're not proactively working a caseload. So, you know, every month you have items that come up that need attention, and we are not in a good place to methodically just proactively work these cases so that we won't get that phone call in the next month or two. So we're definitely still in a reactive mode. And then the other piece I had mentioned earlier was we continue to have things that we can't do, then they stack up, then we get the ability to do it, and then we have this big stack that we need to work on. And so it also puts us in that reactive mode where we're not Because we didn't handle it when we first got it, because we couldn't do it, we're still in those modes. So we're not quite in a, we're not looking forward yet.
Yeah, just a final brief comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of praise the counties for the work that they are doing and have been doing tirelessly for the last several years. And I just know from my experience when I've had constituents call, particularly with an appointment that's coming up, a pretty important appointment with an oncologist or something of that nature, and have had a great deal of frustrations trying to get through the system online or the department. You know, if I can help them get through to the counties have been extremely responsive, particularly in those emergency situations, and have brought them the best results. And so on top of everything else you guys are dealing with, you're really responsive to people when they need it most. So I just thank you for that, and thank you to the great workers in my county of Dakota County, because they've made a huge difference in a lot of people's personal lives that are in a really dire situation after weeks and weeks of waiting. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. And kind of to that point, what you mentioned, the hotline has helped resolve some cases quickly. What happens to those cases that the hotline is unable to help? Then where do they go? What's the next step?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Fishbach.
They're handled. They're just put in a queue and a workload, and then they're not handled really quickly, but they are handled. So this state might be able to answer this question more accurately, but I think sometimes they're in a queue that's, you know, behind a month or two.
So, okay, so how many, for numbers like for Dakota County, how many might you have in that queue waiting to go?
I do not have an answer for you on that one.
Okay.
I don't have anything off the top of my head I can.
Okay, thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned for the online applications, sometimes there's a glitch and it needs a little nudge across the line. You don't need to go into specifics of those glitches unless it's useful in your application. But is there a process for feeding those up to MnSure? Do you feel you're being responded to? And are you getting resolution? Are you seeing progress on resolving some of those glitches to the extent that they're system generated, not user generated?
Ms. Hoskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. There is a regular way of submitting sort of help desk tickets to the state, and they are paying attention to those. Sometimes they go into a queue because there's quite a few of them. But the state is paying attention to those, and they do respond and resolve and let us know when they have been able to resolve them. Sometimes they don't have a solution because the system at this time is not able to make that change, whatever the change or adjustment is, and so that has to be handled manually, and there are people at the state who may be able to do that if they can. The county can't always have access to the system in the same way that the state people do, but they are paying attention to them. Whether they can resolve them is another matter.
Senator Benson.
That's all. I was just asking about governance structure, so
thank you. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess start where Representative Mack left off and say thank you very much. We know you guys are on the front line dealing with these issues, and we appreciate it. Two questions that I had. Number one is on the no wrong door issue. From a customer's perspective, in fact, put yourselves in that position right now. You're sitting down. You got your choice. You can either try it the online fashion or you can do paper. Knowing what you know now, what would you do today? Would you seek to apply online, or would
Ms.
you
Hoskins?
Go to the paper route?
So I'll answer for myself, and Marty can answer for herself, Mr. Chair and Representative. One of the biggest lessons that we've learned is to have all your documentation, all your information before you start the application. So if I had all that together, or all that I knew that I needed to have to enter my application successfully, I'd do it online. Because if I have to do a paper application, it might take a much longer time.
Sounds like when we were doing college financial aid stuff. But anyway.
Right.
Same Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would do the same thing. I would go online.
Okay. And then second question, Mr. Chairman. There's been some talk of scuttling what we're doing right now and going to a federal exchange. My understanding, and I'm looking to you guys to tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that even if you do that, folks still have to go through the eligibility process. You have to have that available here in Minnesota, and that our existing system doesn't have the ability to process the Magi information that's required, mm-hmm. whether you have a federal or state exchange. But this is your chance. Should we scuttle Venture and go to the federal exchange, or would you prefer to stick with and continue down the path?
First of all, I'm going to say that the association and the county that I represent don't have a position on that, so I'm not going to get into that.
That's fair.
I do think one very important consideration is whether or not we will be able to move towards integration of services, with health care being such a key part of individuals and families' lives, and trying to help people in poverty or people who need social services. If we go to a federal exchange or some other system, are we going to be able to make progress to integrate those systems in the future? That would be the question I have.
Ms. Fishbach, to the Atkins question.
I have the same answer. The association in my community doesn't have a position on which way to go, and I would echo it's really important for us to move to modern systems that will talk to each other so that it's seamless for people, particularly like the ones that Ms. Huskins described, where you come in and you are interested in food and cash and health care, and you want to be able to do that in as seamless as you can for people.
Person Atkins.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll start with the theme. Thank you guys for all the work that you've done. I appreciate it. I remember maybe 15, 16 years ago, Ms. Huskins, maybe I'm dating myself when I used to work for you myself, so I know how long you've been at it and how hard it's been to kind of make these transitions, and I thank you for kind of helping bridge in that for the folks that report directly to you. I guess I'd like to say that I think I'm happy. Much happier than I've been in a long time. It seems like things are going better than they have before. It seems like the accountability and governance structure is working. Sounds like the wizards and other technical pieces that are putting in are starting to kind of bear some fruit. So I know that we got a long ways to go to get working, you know, prospectively again like we used to and be able to figure it out and catch up, but it sounds like we're getting there. I guess my question would be that we spent a little time with various members talking about what would you rather do, a paper or electronic, or I think Representative Atkins kind of asked you what would you do. But I think that the question that needs to be said is, and I was talking to Senator Benson about it, is what would the client, the person that we're dealing with, do? And I think and I know you've probably answered this in that context, but I heard you say, well, it all depends on if I had everything put together and I was ready to go. Well, often the people that show up don't. They're needing help. They're displaced. Something has happened in their life where they're coming to get some support from us, especially if they're coming for food and cash assistance, maybe medical assistance. You might be a little more stable. So I think that part of what we need to do is to also understand that as automated as we want to become, we're still going to be dealing with people who are in crisis, who are coming with a lot of issues, who are going to need some assistance from our staff to get through. Now, I guess to form this in a question, Ms. Chair, is does the automated side of this automatically mean that the consumer, the client, is going to be the one putting in the information, or is there going to also be a worker who can also make it an automated process that helps the client put the information in there? I get the automation side of that and how it can be seamless, and if you have everything and everything's working, you can get through pretty quickly. But the question is, do you guys foresee in the work that you do that clients are going to really be able to sit at home at their kitchen table with a cup of coffee and get through this process? Because I think that that's often what people think about when we talk about the automation.
Ms. Huskins?
Mr. Chair and Senator, you're absolutely right in how you describe many of the people who come to the county for help. I would say there's a variety of answers to that. I think some of our younger people and younger generations who are more comfortable with and used to using some technology will not have as difficult a time. Definitely in Hennepin County, we have many people, as you're very well aware, who are not computer literate or don't speak English or come from a different country and really don't even understand our system, let alone try to enter the information correctly into an application. And so I think there's still a role for county workers. There's also a role for other people to help out. And it is my understanding that, and the state can testify to this, but there's a functionality that's being rolled out for assisters to enter applications for people, and that's in addition to the navigator role that's already been in place for a while.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's kind of what I thought, that we were working on the functionality, and it continues to continuing to work so that it works at its optimum performance. But it does sound like, you know, if we think about the clients who were assisting, the clients that are coming, that they're still going to need often some sort of assistance in either getting in the system or gathering the information. I know that it's open enrollment now for us, and so often we need some help gathering information and understanding what are the right things that we need to do in order for us to make the right decisions about the benefits that we receive. So I just want to say thank you guys for all of the work that you continue to do, but continue to hopefully articulate the difference between having a fully automated system that has a really good outcome for clients, but also who the clients are that are coming to receive those services. They still may need help from your staff. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Hayden, I think I was thinking kind of down that same line, and maybe Ms. Fishbach and Ms. Hoskins could help out. If you're waiting for a renewal 10, 12, 15 months, what's the conversation between DHS and the counties and the enrollees? What are you hearing from them when with the backlog? What concerns do they have? Ms. Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, so one of the things that with the renewals is that if you weren't renewed yet, you still had medical coverage, so it might have been, everything was probably going okay. If you had a change and you had a renewal, that's where things get a little bit tricky, because when they're in this renewal status, at this juncture, we can't make a change on a case. So that could be a little bit tricky, but I think that's what I've mostly heard of is that concern, and I'm not sure if you have anything to add on that.
Ms. Hoskins.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any stories or anecdotes or feedback from clients on what are the difficult issues that they're having right now, other than kind of the general. There's nothing that's popping out right now as a particular theme. There were quite a few people with the renewal process that's been going on over the past months. A number of people who had not responded to notices and had not multiple notices and had not done anything, those have been cut off of the system and will continue to be as their renewal time comes up. And some of those are coming back in for reapplication or redetermination. That process is taking a long time right now, but hopefully that's just going to be for a few months here and we'll get past that.
Okay, if there's no more questions from members, we will move on. I want to thank Ms. Fishbach and Hoskins for coming before the committee today. We really appreciate it. Let's go with Commerce at this point. It'd be my intention then after Commerce to go to the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and then we'll go to Minsure. And as far as I'm concerned, we can go all night. The Cubs don't play tonight, so it's I'm totally open. Isn't that something? How about those Cubs? You just got to love them. You got to love them. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Minnesota Department of Commerce. And, Mr. Chairman, before I begin, my sincere apologies to you and the members of the committee for being tardy earlier and not prompt in my arrival. My apologies for disrupting the committee's schedule.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman, as many of you know, the Minnesota Department of Commerce released rate information for products to be sold in the individual and small group markets on October 1st of this year. And so I'm going to run quickly through just a high-level review of what the Commerce Department released at that time, and then talk about some of the market stabilization reforms as well that we talked about in our press conference on the 1st. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have copies of Commissioner Rothman's letter to the chairs of the Healthcare Financing Task Force, and I'll get into that later. But if members were interested, that letter's been distributed, but just in case other folks have not seen it.
Mr. Brickwood, you're saying you have it there?
Yes.
To be distributed? If someone could please distribute, Mr. Reynolds will take care of that. Thank you. Please proceed, sir.
Mr. Chairman, as members know, fundamentally, the way that the rate review process works is that health insurers seeking to sell products in Minnesota make filings with the Minnesota Department of Commerce and the Minnesota Department of Health for of their products for sale, and the Commerce Department approves the rates and policy contracts that are to be sold in the state. Fundamentally, the rates proposed by the insurance companies must pay for expected policyholder claims and expenses for providing the insurance. And the Commerce Department is nationally recognized as one of as having an effective rate review process, the designation given to us by the federal government. There were two unique features of the rate review process this year that were not part of the process previously. The first was that this year, for the first time, the federal government published proposed rates filed by the companies with the, not only the state regulators but also with federal regulators of proposed rates that were higher than 10%. And so those were made public. And as a feature of that, the second difference this year from previous years was that members of the public were able to submit comments to both state regulators and federal regulators on those proposed rates. In the individual market, we had increases, some fairly significant. They varied by company. I would stress, too, that while the rates that were announced for the individual market, we saw significant instability in that market this year, that applies only to a small portion of the population of Minnesota. Nearly 95% of Minnesotans access their health insurance coverage either through public programs or elsewhere in the market. I would say, too, that the level of rate increases was of great concern, I'd be happy to provide to members, and their information is publicly available on the Commerce website, information about specific carriers, but I will leave it to the plans to speak for themselves on that. But I do think I'd like to mention briefly that the Commerce Department, in looking at the instability in the individual market in particular, has also identified and are looking forward to discussing with the membership of the healthcare task force that that there are potentially other further destabilizing items that could come down the pike from the federal level as well. And so in the letter that was distributed, the commissioner requested that the task force take a look at four market stabilization reform proposals, the first being Minnesota-specific price stability mechanisms along the lines of the federal price stability mechanisms that are already in place or other models that we have in Minnesota, looking and examining insurers' reserves and profits, looking for greater price transparency and cost competition in the marketplace, and taking a look at the option of merging the individual and small group risk pools. I'm sure members have questions, and I'd be happy to take them. I would also add, too, that as members know, the Minnesota Department of Health reviews filings for network adequacy, and so I may defer questions related to networks to my colleagues from the Department of Health. But, Mr. Chairman, I'd perhaps leave it there and see if there are questions for members.
Thank you. We do have some questions here. Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Brickwitty. At the press conference, the commissioner, and I'm asking you, but the commissioner's not here, during his press conference, he said that the rates, I think in general, were unacceptably high. He also said that the department had squeezed out everything that wasn't actuarially justified or necessary. I don't recall, but it seems like there's a little bit of a dichotomy there. Can you expand on that?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, the commissioner did say that the rates were unacceptable, and I would stand by that. I think his comments about rates being lowered from what were proposed is, as to your point, having to do with whether or not rates are in compliance with Minnesota law and whether or not they're actuarially justified in their initial filing. As members know, the rate review process is an iterative one, and ultimately the Commerce Department is bound by the law to approve rates if they comply with the law. To the extent that they don't, that's part of the rate review process to make sure that they are prior to them being approved or they are not.
Chairman Hoppe. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, I mean, if we've squeezed out everything that's not actuarially justified and they're still unacceptably high, where do we go from here?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, I think that's a good question, and I think that's part of the reason why the Commerce Department has asked the task force to take a look at these market stability reforms. I'll let the plan speak for themselves. I know they're on the agenda for later in the hearing, but, you know, what the plans in their filings spoke to were that the drivers were the higher underlying healthcare costs, higher cost of prescription drugs, and higher utilization by a sicker population in the individual market than what was anticipated. And Commissioner Rothman spoke to that as well during the press conference. And those are drivers that hopefully the task force is, I know the task force is looking at how to wrap the state's arms around those issues. But in addition, in the individual market, we saw rates go up because we have some instability in that market. And so the package of reform ideas we think will help stabilize or have a stabilizing effect on rates going forward.
Chairman Hopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brickwitty, to that point, we still have MCHA through the end of the year, at least in law. Would we be better off figuring out a way to keep MCHA going?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Hoppe, MCHA remains, Chapter 62E certainly remains on the books. In practical terms, there are extremely limited number of enrollees who are still receiving coverage, however, not through the insurance coverage that was previously provided by MCHA. What I mean by that is that there are a very small specific population that has a contract in place, a contractual arrangement that is in place providing coverage for a particular type of service that is not widely covered in the individual market. And that will be that is in place. I'll be happy to go into further detail with that. But backing out, MCHA enrollees prior to the ACA reforms in Minnesota by law were charged higher, between 101 and 125% of market price, in order to receive their coverage. And they were a population of folks who were unable to receive coverage in the individual market because they were denied, typically because of a pre-existing condition or the particular treatment or benefit that those individuals were relying on for their health care was not covered in the private market. And so I think from the consumer standpoint, and I think this is why we saw MCHA enrollees transition in high numbers at a much faster rate than either the Commerce Department or the carriers themselves anticipated, was because it was to their benefit to find coverage in the private market.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll one more question, I'll let it go. And there's not a perfect answer to this. This is a crystal ball question. You know, here we are with rates that have gone way up. We're not talking about the lowest insurance rates in the country anymore. So rates have gone way up. They're unacceptably high, but we've squeezed everything that's not justified, not actuarially justified out of them. Crystal ball, what do we do next year?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, I think if I had a crystal ball, I'd be coming to your committee to talk about gambling issues a lot more frequently. But I think that, you know, we do need to take a serious look at the reform proposals that the Commerce Department is asking the healthcare task force to take a look at. We do need to provide some stability to the individual market in order to make sure that the consumers that are purchasing in that market do not continue to experience this yo-yo effect that they are going to experience this year with rate increases.
Chairman Hoppe.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brickwitty, I apologize. I said that was the last one. But So if we want to avoid this, would we avoid this if we just went to the federal exchange? And I'm not proposing that. I'm just, this is a year crystal ball question again.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, no. States that operate on healthcare.gov and the federal exchange still go through the same state-based rate review process that Minnesota does. So nothing at the Commerce Department would change, and in fact, in many cases for consumers, back-end processes related to if there are consumer complaints would become more complicated because they would still come back to St. Paul. However, they just would be routed to us through folks in Washington.
Chair Hoppe.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think part of the issue here is I think my good friend Commissioner Rothman maybe picked an unacceptable word by saying unacceptable because they were justified. The rates were justified, however high they were. And you'd mentioned that there's higher cost, higher utilization, higher prescription drug costs. That means that the rates have to go up. So I guess I'll visit with Commissioner Rothman about his meaning of the word unacceptable. Unacceptable means like it's wrong. Yeah, I don't like the higher rates. I mean, I really get hit in the Southeast because we were 2 to 3 times as high as anybody anyways. So I don't think the word's really unacceptable. I think they're justified, but I don't like them. So maybe we're just having a little bit of trouble with that word. And with the four issues he's looking at in the letter, one was creating a reinsurance program to offset premium increases. How would that be paid for? Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, that is a very good question, and I think one that we'll be discussing with the members of the task force. I think there are probably a variety of ways that the state could pay for that, a state-specific mechanism. And I think the commissioner spoke about price stability mechanisms, of which reinsurance is one. The three R's, risk corridors, risk adjustment, and federal reinsurance at the federal level are one possibility or some subset of those. Minnesota has other examples here at the state, the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association, for example, which has worked for many years in a different insurance world. And there may be others. And so that's a conversation that we're looking forward to in the task force.
And thank you, Mr. Brickwood. And we will have further conversations because item two, review of insurance company reserves, I don't see how that saves us anything because he's already said he squeezed everything out he could. Enhanced competition and transparency, merging small group and individual markets, I don't really see how any of them work, but we'll have the discussion and we'll go from there. I am in no way criticizing. I haven't criticized Commissioner Rothman at all for approving the massive rate increases that we've had because there wasn't really a choice. We cannot have our carriers with unfit reserves or unacceptable reserves. They have to have the reserves. And I think Commissioner Rothman was put in a very tough situation. He made a decision that he really didn't have a choice on. So with that, we'll go to Senator.
Excuse me, Representative. May I just
To that point, yes.
To that point. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Davids, because my thinking is along the same line as yours. I just wanted to ask a couple questions on this issue because my understanding is the same.
Excuse me, Senator. I have a list here, and I'll do to that point thing. So you're on our list. Senator Benson, Lori, Mack, and then the Senator. So Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Brickwitty. Thank you for being here. You and I are like in meetings every week now, so I'm going to this. You might not have the answer for me, but I'd appreciate going forward with the change in rates. And given that we're the MNSURE Oversight Committee and we have open enrollment coming, this would be helpful. How many more people do you believe will be eligible for an advanced premium tax credit? Because that's going to put additional pressure previously not anticipated on MNSURE. And as we go forward, I'd like, if we have numbers, that would be helpful.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, and my apologies, I can't answer that question for you as the Commerce Department doesn't deal with tax credit eligibility. But so I would defer that question to MNSURE.
Senator Benson.
And I apologize, Mr. Brickwitty. You're right. That's not Commerce's responsibility. And I can't figure out how I was going to orient that to ask you, but I will follow up. I know how to find you. It's just with the large shift, I thought maybe you'd have some indication. But I'll follow up with you. I apologize. Usually I ask you really hard questions and you get me answers. This one, there was no, I apologize, Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, Mr. Brickwitty. Always happy to help, and I'll see you at the meeting we're in together tomorrow. So. Yep.
Thank you. Senator Lori, Chairman Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, I guess Kind of to Representative Hoppe's line of questioning, it is a, you know, I mean, I think what we're dealing with here is looking at the actuarial value of the cost of health care and actually in a reforming marketplace starting to stabilize and figure out what that is. And it's a difficult conversation when, you know, in the first couple of years out, you know, some of the assumptions about who would show up and the risk profile of the individual market, you know, didn't really come to fruition. And that's one of the biggest drivers behind this. Certainly there is rising healthcare costs, particularly in the pharmaceutical area, and there's other drivers as well. But I think what we really need to be looking at is, and having a broad public conversation, not just in the legislature, but is about the cost of healthcare and whether we think that's something that we need to be working on collectively. And some of these mechanisms might actually mask that, the true cost of healthcare, in a way that doesn't foster the conversation. So I'll be asking some of those questions. I think that merging of the individual and small group, I mean, right now with the individual market at about 300,000 and the small group at about 300,000, two separate risk pools, merging them, you know, doubles each of them and might actually be of quite a bit of benefit in the ability to spread the risk a little bit more evenly and mitigate some of this. And some of these are interesting ideas that I am on the task force and look forward to dealing with that. But as we look to the future of healthcare, you know, the cost of healthcare is going to have to be a driver, and that's what some of the payment reforms over in the health side that we're looking at, trying to drive better value. We spend more per capita on healthcare than any other industrialized country in the world. You know, and there is enough money, broadly speaking, in the healthcare system to do much better by patients. We spend more, and we don't necessarily get better outcomes always. So it's a difficult conversation, but I think that's where we're going to have to turn, because from the commerce perspective, you're right. I mean, this is an actuarially, you're becoming more of an actuarially sound analysis of the cost of healthcare for this risk pool. We can change that a little bit. We can, you know, collect a premium and do reinsurance, a risk corridor, a risk adjustment. We can do some of those things if we wish. We'll have to look at how it affects federal revenues and things like that and fits within the context of the system that we're trying to deliver in Minnesota. But I think the answers are going to have to come from the health side of the equation. Once Commerce has approved actuarially sound rates, that means neither too high nor too low. But then also to that point, I think that I don't think we're off the chart with our premiums today in terms of where we stand in the upper Midwest and in the country. I know not everybody has their rates out, but I guess most of this has been a comment, but maybe you could give us some of the updated information because I know more states are making their rates public as we approach open enrollment. So where do we stand in terms of our rates compared to other states?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, thank you for that question. And we do, Chairman Hoppe, I think you're correct. We have moved upwards, but we still, I think, are very competitive compared to the rest of the nation, and certainly compared to our neighbors. Our neighboring states, we will be the lowest in the upper Midwest. And Mr. Chairman, to your earlier point about there being some differentiation between different parts of the state, that is a significant issue, particularly in southeastern Minnesota. I, along with colleagues from Minture and DHS and MDH, were down in Cannon Falls just last week talking to members of the community there about the concerns that they see and how they're affected by being right on the border between two geographic rating areas where 4 or 5 miles down the road their costs may be a little bit different compared to what they're paying. So there are certainly things to tackle in that environment. And, Senator, I appreciate your comments and willingness to work with us in the task force to come up with the right set of ideas to bring some stability to the market.
Senator Lurie. Okay. And to that point that you brought up as far as the different areas and the rates, you know, in the southeast we're 2 to 3 times as high as they are, for example, in Hennepin County. And we had a bill working in a bipartisan fashion, Representative Liebling and myself, to correct that. But, of course, all the other areas were not supportive of that because it would be a shift onto some of them if we even got close to being at their rate. So I think that will be discussed further here. I have in the queue Representative Mack, Senator Sharon, Representative Hoppe, and then Representative Murphy E. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Brickwoody. Just a question to go back briefly to the commissioner's press conference where he talked about this reinsurance program that, you know, the concept seems to be similar to something like MCHA, but I understand it's something that he would like to see discussed with the Healthcare Financing Task Force. But I'm curious as to something that I heard in that press conference where he alluded to an interest in paying for something like this with the sick tax and a continuing of the sick tax that is supposed to be sunsetted, and it's kind of a source of money that I think is going to be fought over for the next couple of years, whether it's to pay for the BHP or many unmet needs going into the future. And I'm just wondering if that is a serious consideration of the commissioner and something that he intends to pursue through the Healthcare Financing Task Force to have the sick tax pay for this reinsurance program.
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think
just to that Senator point, I'm confused about the sick tax. Is that the provider tax that you're referring to?
Excuse me. Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair, the all provider right. tax.
Senator Hayden. Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, thank you for that clarification. Representative, to your question, I think all options are on the table, and I think that's where the Healthcare Financing Task Force provides a welcome opportunity to have not only legislators but stakeholders from across the healthcare spectrum come together and talk about some of these ideas. So we're going to be giving a presentation to the Seamless Coverage Working Group next Thursday, and so kind of laying out details of kind of what we see these programs are. But again, as I mentioned earlier in response to the Chairman David's question, there are a variety of different models. The reinsurance at the federal level is one of the models, but there are other risk mitigation programs in place, as you know, in the amongst the three that are currently in place, only one of which is permanent, the Workers' Comp Reinsurance Association being another model that's paid through an assessment. So there are, MCHA is another example, but there are a variety of models. I think everything is on the table, but we haven't honed in on one specific idea.
Chair Mack.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that answer and understand that that will certainly be part of a larger discussion. I think a lot of ears perk up when it comes to the provider tax. Certainly the providers out there who are budgeting and planning for that to sunset as they were told it would be doing, and now they understand that is certainly being revisited to pay for many things. So I was just curious on those comments from the commissioner. My one other question for you, and if you don't have the answer today, if you could just follow up, but in this last session, in the Health and Human Services Finance Bill, we appropriated $423,000 to the Department of Commerce for the waiver option of looking at applying to the federal government that people would have access to the advanced tax credits if they shop outside of MNCHR. And I'm wondering where we're at in the process with that money appropriated, what's the timeline, and where Commerce is on that.
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mack, thank you for that question. And for a time, and my thanks to Senator Lori and Chairman Dean and yourself and others who were on that conference committee for about a month, that was the sole budget for the entirety of the Commerce Department until we got to the special session. So, and thank you to the legislature for appropriating those dollars for that project. We are in process on that. We are in the process of trying to figure out if we can obtain a consultant to help us along with that process, and Senator Benson and I have had a couple of conversations along the way about that. But for members who perhaps don't know, the Commerce Department was directed by the legislature, as Representative Mack said, to seek federal waivers for individuals to be able to obtain tax credit assistance outside of the exchange. The process for doing that is through a 1332 waiver, so-called, at the federal level, and to date, no state has even attempted to or filed an application for a 1332 waiver at the federal government. Hawaii is the furthest along in the process, and it took, they have just, I think within the last month or month and a half, released their idea for what they want to seek. It took them a year of task force work to get to that point. So in many respects, the Commerce Department, the state of Minnesota, is operating in the blind in terms of exactly how to design a waiver application and what the process would look like once one is actually submitted to the federal government. The regulations are opaque, to put it kindly, I think, and the federal government has, as Senator Benson, as you and I talked about last week, has up to at least a half a year to even approve any waiver once it is submitted. The process also involves things like public hearings in a geographically dispersed area around the state. So it is going to be a quite involved process. So we're at the front end of that. I would say, in addition, the Healthcare Financing Task Force has been discussing 1332 waivers very broadly, and I would expect that conversation to continue on a variety of different topics. And so there may be opportunities, once the task force makes its recommendations in January, to the legislature to either combine forces to think about these in different ways. So I think that will be an ongoing conversation, and happy to keep you as updated as you would like going forward. So.
Chair Mack.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm going back again to what Representative Davids was talking about, which was the sort of framing the discussion about the increased rates as unacceptable. So it's in that context that you were talking that I'm going back to, because I thought it was really important just in the last meeting as well to separate this from MNsure itself, that the rates are increased not because of MNsure but because of a variety of driving forces, and that the commissioner has made some recommendations for what we can do to stabilize these rates, but as the point has been made, and I want to repeat, that the driving forces are broader than simply fixing the structure. Underlying that is a lot of behavior, and it also includes our outcome expectations that we have of health care providers now that we want to reimburse based on outcome. It is influenced by what we believe it should be covered in a health insurance policy beyond the essential benefits, and that's a value system that we struggle with all the time. Pharmaceutical charges, which I think we really have to get our arms around as a legislature. The reserves, you know, I think it's fair and open to me yet whether or not the reserves are in excess or what people are spending money on within the insurance companies themselves, that we have to continue to get transparency from the insurance companies. There's a variety of ways of diving in and trying to get control over the costs of healthcare, which are inflating more than the general inflation in the state. So in the region of the state, I want to reinforce that, because I live in a rural part of the state that has similar difficulties that Representative Davids is talking about, and also how negotiated rates occur because of the regions and how many providers there are in those regions. So these are complex things that influence the rates throughout the state, and I think that it will be a complex solution. So the question, having said all of that, reaffirming that we're still the lowest in the surrounding area, all of the states surrounding us are higher than we are in rates. We still anticipate being in at least the lowest quartile in the United States after all rates come in, so our rates are still lower. So my question, when the commissioner says that it's unacceptable, does he have in his mind what an acceptable rate increase is and what we should be measuring our effectiveness in terms of all these interventions against?
Mr. Brickwitty?
What is an acceptable rate increase percentage? Thank you,
Senator. Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, thank you for your comments, certainly. I wouldn't want to speak for Commissioner Rothman, because I've not personally posed that question to him in terms of whether or not he has an acceptable, quote-unquote, rate increase amount in his mind. I think you are quite correct that our rates remain competitive compared certainly to our neighbors and the nation at large. I think what is of significant concern is the instability in the market, which has led to unacceptable rate increases this year. So I think that's our aim. Our goal is to work with the legislature and all stakeholders to find a way to get a handle on what is driving those rate increases. I think you're quite correct that there are a number of factors related to the cost of health care and the other items that you laid out that are driving that beyond just the pricing of insurance. And there is variation across the state. So it is our challenge to be able to try to provide that stabilizing effect. And I think that, again, as, and having been down in your part of the state and spoken with your constituents directly about the price differential between your part of the state and the metro area in particular, that we have now the ability or the data to see that price differential in a way that perhaps we didn't prior to health reform implementation in Minnesota. And so that's our challenge to try to, now that we can see it, what are we going to do about it?
Senator Lori?
There's an interesting nuance in here, and we keep mixing terms a little bit because it was framed as unacceptable rates, or is it unacceptable rate increases? And I'd like to get some clarity as to which they're different. You know, I mean, the rate is a number. It's an amount per month, and I'd always include cost sharing in it too, as the cost to the individual. But is the cost that the consumers are bearing unacceptable according to the commissioner, or is the rate increase unacceptable? I mean, because the rate increase speaks to stability in a market, and maybe we're getting there, maybe we're not, maybe we need some tools. The unacceptable rate issue. Which is it? They're two different things.
Mr. Brick.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lori, you're correct, and I think we are talking about two separate things. We're talking about, when I talk about rates, we're talking about premiums for health insurance products, but I think what you've been speaking about, too, is the cost of receiving care. And I think,
It's affordability.
Being able to afford your insurance is one thing, but also being able to afford being sick is also another thing, to be able to utilize the benefits that you have for insurance coverage. And that is a challenge I know that the task force is wrestling with, particularly in the seamless coverage working group, looking at where some of those cliffs are for cost, certainly, and also for benefit and plan design. So I think you're quite correct in pointing out that they're both a significant challenge to the state and to the Commerce Department and our fellow agencies.
Senator Lori?
I guess the question was Commissioner Rothman's statement about unacceptability, was it about unacceptable rates or was it about unacceptable rate increases?
Mr. Brickbody?
Or was it both?
Mr. Brickbody?
Mr. Chairman, I think rate increases, but I think in general both. I think we are competitive, but when you go from number one to, I don't know exactly where we're going to land because not every state has released their rates. It'd be nice to be number one again.
Senator, I apologize, Senator Sharon. I didn't follow up to see if you were done.
Well, I would just thank you. I am reacting to the rate increases, which I don't like either. And we're talking about this individual market, not the small group, which had some decreases. So we're talking about the individual market, and it's a narrow market. But nevertheless, this question, this discussion about us establishing what is an acceptable rate increase, what we need to define that, I think. And as we need to define more clearly our affordability standard, which has to do with the actual cost of the product. And we aren't going to do that here or now, but it complicates this discussion, which is about the cost to health care and its inflating costs. And then my final point is I want to separate that from, and the role of commerce in relationship to this, from MNsure in the public side, that it's not MNsure that's driving the cost of health care, but a number of other factors that I was articulating earlier.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. And Senator Lori, are you on that task force?
I am.
Could you do me a favor and please make sure that there's any openings my name is not mentioned? Okay, Chairman Hoppe.
No, I can assure you that the Senate majority won't put you on.
Well, Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I have a bunch of new questions after hearing all this. And I think globally as a society and as a legislature and the various committees that are looking at this, we need to differentiate between health care and health insurance. We don't use health insurance like we use auto insurance or homeowners. We use it as a direct means of transferring money and paying for health care. But having said that, Senator Sharon, you just said, and I'm paraphrasing, but that you wanted to differentiate between commerce and MNsure, and that MNsure is not driving the cost. I'd like to know if Mincher is driving costs. When we're looking at the rate increases that the health plans have put forward that we find unacceptably high, how much of their rate increases are based on additional people they've had to hire to do the work that they're required to do by the ACA? And I don't know if that's a question you can answer, Mr. Brickwitty, or if the plans shed some light on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, certainly the plans can speak for themselves, but in terms of what they filed with the Commerce Department, and this is all public in their actuarial memorandum that are now publicly available now that rates are final, but the answer is zero. That was not a factor as part of the baked into the rate requests that were made by the companies.
Chairman Hoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Brickwitty, for that answer. And I find it interesting that they've told us in the past that they've had to hire additional people, and that apparently costs nothing.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, again, the plans can speak for themselves, but I think the factors that go into the pricing of health insurance, as we've talked about before, are driven by the underlying factors applying across the entire market. So again, I'll let the plan speak to the administrative side of their operations, but in terms of what they filed with the Commerce Department for approval for 2016, that was not one of the factors that was included.
Thank you.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, this is more of a commerce question. If we do take the sick tax, and Senator Hayden, I had the same question you do, just to make sure we're talking about the same tax, just to make sure we're all on the same page. If we use that tax for reinsurance, what happens to the BHP funding?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, I don't have the answer to that question. I think that's one possible scenario that the healthcare task force could help us take a look at. I think that would be the same with any potential funding source. And as always, that will require legislative action at the end of the day, so I'm sure that will be something that the chairs of the relevant committee will also wrestle with during the session.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Brickwitty. You were talking earlier about merging markets or merging the individual market to the small group. What do you think the impact would be on the small group market if we do that?
Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, I think this is a really interesting question and one that I think is going to require some further analysis. What we have seen in the two markets is that the rates in the two markets are converging. Mm-hmm. And so I think to Senator Lori's earlier point, we've got about 300,000 covered lives in each market. So putting them together, I think, will broaden that base, and that will have an impact. I think we think a stabilizing impact on rates for that new merged market. But the devil's in the details. As you know, I'm not an actuary, so I can't tell you for absolute certain, but that is one of the things that we want to, I think, particularly look at with the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Rickway. Do you know what the definition of an actuary is?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you're going to tell me.
A CPA without a personality. Chairman Hoppe.
It's always hard to follow the chairman.
He said it.
I don't know that there's a question anywhere in here. I'm going to try to decipher my notes I've been scribbling here as people have been asking questions and answering. But, and I'm not sure who said this, but I think when we're talking about is this a function, I think Senator Lori, you're talking about rates versus increases. And I'm not sure that it matters because I think what we're seeing with plans leaving the exchange and the you know, unacceptable high increases, I think they're just getting to where the cost should have been in the first place. And my guess is that next year we won't see anywhere near this kind of increase as the things start to kind of level out. So I don't know that we can say it's the rates or the increases. I think it's one and the same, two sides of the same coin. And when we talk about lowest rates, whether we have the lowest rates in the region or in the country, I don't think we can look at, and I don't think the people that are having to write checks to pay for this care what we are compared to, you know, Wisconsin or Virginia or whatever. I care about what people are paying now with the Affordable Care Act in place versus what they would have been paying before that legislation passed. And I think that's the only valid comparison we should be looking at. How much more are people paying for health care or health insurance or access to it right now? And I don't know if there's Mr. Brickwitty, if you want to give that a shot, I don't know if that's an answerable question right now.
Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, of course, the answer is going to be different for every person, but certainly for those individuals who were unable to access coverage at all or insurance at all because they either had a pre-existing condition or were otherwise not able to find coverage for their particular treatment or benefit, I think there is significant value. Again, going back to the MCHA population, for example, by law, those 26,000 enrollees were all paying above the market rate, 101 to 125% of what they would have been able to get a comparable plan for if they had been able to buy one in the pre-existing market. So, again, the difference is it's going to be a different answer for every individual. It's certainly going to depend in the individual market about whether or not you have access to tax credit assistance or other some sort of subsidy assistance. It's going to be different for every employer, depending on the size of your business and what market you're making decisions in. So I don't think, Representative Hoppe, to your point, that's a definitively answerable question, but I think for large segments of the population in Minnesota, costs are lower, or they are certainly receiving benefits that previously weren't covered.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brickwitty, every once in a while I like to just throw you a softball. And I know that there are people that were not able to get coverage before that have it now. My suspicion is that the people that did have insurance before are going to be paying more than they were before. But I get you, like you say, it's a case-by-case basis. Couple of more things and then I'll be done, and I can't read a lot of my notes here, so that's good for all of us. When we're talking about, I think more broadly, when we're talking about, as I mentioned earlier, health care versus health insurance, I think one of the things that we need to look at isn't necessarily a Department of Commerce or a MNsure or an insurance perspective. I think it's looking at how we do things in health care. And I know that this is not analogous across the board, but if we look at the way that people pay for laser eye surgery, that gets better and cheaper all the time, and it's covered by virtually no one's insurance because we have competition. And I know that healthcare isn't a commodity where you can just go and, you know, people like their doctor and they like, you know, the way that things are done, and it's about access and who they can get to. And I understand all that. It's not completely analogous. But I think if we can figure out a way to introduce more competition and more choice for people in this, that's going to drive rates down the way it is done, the way that we've looked at for LASIK surgery. And last thing I've got is I wanted to follow up on what Chairman David said, and I'm not sure if it was Senator Sharon or Senator Lori, but I would like to, like Chair David's did, say I'm not blaming Commissioner Rothman for approving these rates. I think that he did what his job is, and it's not his, not that I'm assigning blame, but I think he looked at this and said these are the rates that these companies have to charge to cover their costs, and it is what it is. And I don't think we want to blame the plans for that, and they are not without blame in helping to get the Affordable Care Act passed. I wouldn't say it didn't pass here. It passed in D.C., so we'll blame those health insurance carriers. But it's not that they're not without blame, but I think they're just looking at what their costs are, which are considerably higher than anybody was thinking. We're not any longer talking about saving every family money or anything like that. Now we're talking about charging them more. But when I think that one of the things that I will say about the insurance company, so I'll give Commissioner Rothman credit for doing that. I do not think we want to touch the reserves. I think insurance companies have to have reserves by their very nature. And if we're going to start forcing them to draw down their reserves, we're going to get them into trouble as, you know, the very model of running an insurance company. So with that, I will let that go. I appreciate the committee's time. Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty and Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Hoppe. I would like to just point out a few things on a couple of things you said regarding the way it was before. I've been in the insurance business 33 years, and I never had a problem with somebody getting health insurance policy. So all this talk about how people couldn't get it before, yes, they could. You should see some of the cases I wrote, and they went on to MSHA, the Act of 1976. So people could get coverage for pre-existing conditions. And the issue as far as MSHA being higher, they were higher on average, but they weren't higher than a lot of companies. Many times we would put people into MSHA because it's a lot cheaper than the plan they had. MSHA could not go above 125% of the average price, but you know, a lot of health insurance companies and their pricing are above average. And so I was able to get a lot of folks, save them a ton of money going to MSHA,
rather than being on the plan that they were on that, you know, we had no pre-existing conditions or anything like that. So a little different thought on that. Okay, Representative Murphy E.
And I was going to ask a question about neighboring rates, but we covered that territory pretty well. And Mr. Chair, your comment about PHMSA made me think a little bit about my experience and history with these issues. And I do have a slightly different perspective, and it is this. Minnesota created PHMSA because the competitive model of health insurance allowed insurance companies to exclude people if they were too costly or too sick. And we, because we're compassionate people, created a backstop for those people, and it was something that was, you know, we raised taxes, if you will, from small business owners and insurance companies to pay for that. And so it is just one iteration of what we have been doing, I think, in Minnesota for a long time, is trying to make sure as compassionate people that when the competitive model of insurance fail to people who need it the most, that we find another means to take care of it, and we all pay for that. And we're just, you know, another step in the generation of that very same model. I'm glad to know that our rates are lower than our neighboring rates. I am happy to know that our rates are in line with the federal rate. But I think we have more work to do as policymakers to think about why healthcare costs so much. And I am not yet convinced that competition is the solution. It didn't help us before it hasn't helped us in the past. And while I guess how it might help in the sale of a car, I don't think consumers have the advantage of expertise and information to be able to price shop in healthcare. And that's why competition is not necessarily the antidote to what we're facing. And with that, I will mute my phone again and listen in attendance. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy E. Okay, I do have to, just a housekeeping issue here. I have a pair of glasses. I had a coffee cup and a pair of glasses. We found the coffee cup owner. Is that correct? Okay, I have this pair of glasses. I'd call them hot cougar panther design, kind of like copies. Kind of like copies. Kind of like copies. I'd say they're about a 20/60 on the left eye and about 20/80 on the right eye. So if anybody need some glasses, I'm certainly not going to keep them, but I'll give them to staff if we don't have a son. I wouldn't claim them now. I would ask after the meeting, and most of the people have left the premises. Okay, item next. Senator Benson and Senator Hayden. Senator Benson.
And I don't want to belabor this because we've got a lot of actual Minshew stuff, not just beating up commerce. But, Mr. Brickwitty, how much have the rates increased since 2010?
Mr. Brickwood.
In the individual market. Mr. Chair, sorry.
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I don't have a number off the top of my head. However, I think that it is not an apples-to-apples comparison over the entirety of that time frame. And what I mean by that is, as sort of been discussed in part here already, health insurance products in 2010 covered a different set of benefits, a different set of things that were constructed in a different way and were accessible to consumers in a different way than they are today in 2015 and will be in 2016. So I think you're kind of comparing two sides of a pretty dramatic change in the marketplace. So I think it's difficult to make a true apples-to-apples comparison from one side of health reform's implementation to the other.
And, Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, I actually chose 2010 because that was kind of when things started moving. But my larger point is, you said the people in MSHA, the 26,000, are better off because they weren't paying that 101 to 125% differential. But look at what's happened to the rest of the market and the pain that's been caused to everybody else, because the feds couldn't keep their nose out of a system that was working. And so that's my frustration as we sit here in the land of our rates are lower and everything's fine. We have really high coinsurance and deductibles. And MSHA was working
And those 26,000 people were at the very least cared for. Now we have created an incredibly expensive, dysfunctional system that doesn't feel transparent, and people are tired of it. And so with all due respect, I know you try to answer questions in a straightforward manner, but this is not a rose garden by any means, and we have to stop pretending. The ACA made healthcare in Minnesota harder, not easier. And MnSure is just one, that was the technical implementation of one piece, but the disruption that this has caused, I sincerely hope that this is the last of the major disruptions the Fed's put on us. And I don't think our small business owners and individuals can take any more. And so with all due respect, parsing out things like the people in MSHA are better off doesn't make the rest of the people who are impacted feel a lot better.
Mr. Brickley, response?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, thank you for that. And my comments were directed on pricing. Again, perhaps not every MSHA enrollee has had access to an agent as good as the chairman. But MSHA's 26,000 enrollees were primarily there because they were denied access to the private insurance market. And so that was my point again early on, price. If they had been able to access the market, they would have been able to do so at a lower price. But your point is well taken that and my intent was certainly in no way to put rose-colored glasses on what has been a challenge, no doubt about it, and a change in our marketplace. But there are still things to work on, and that's part of what we're looking at trying to do in providing stability in the individual market, for example. So looking forward to working with you on that.
Senator Benson.
No more, thank you.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that some of this stuff that by the time I raise my hand has been covered. This is the conversation about MnSHA and if it was better than what folks have today. And as Representative Murphy said, the compassion of the people of this state that I think I see it a little different. I think people, though maybe not happy, maybe there has been some disruption, I think that people really do have a value system here that they want to cost share the cost of health care for people that have a pre-existing condition or couldn't readily access the insurance market if it wasn't for MSHA, and now we've kind of merged that into one. I do think the pre-existing condition conversation is looked upon differently depending upon who you are. But what I wanted to talk a little bit about is there is a crisis in our community in chemical health and behavioral health around the opioids, around people who are addicted to either Oxycontin or if they can't get that, then heroin. And it is something that is touching almost all of Minnesota. And it's particularly touching young people. And right now, young folks can stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26 years old. And a lot of those insurance organizations, if you will, that are here today are covering that. They're covering the cost for these young people to get well, to deal with the issues of chemical abuse. We've done a lot of work in this legislature on trying to deal with that issue, uncover it. We've done legislation to try to make sure we have the Narcan with first responders to make sure people don't die, and then they go on and get get assessed for their chemical health issues or behavioral health issues, and then go into treatment and get well. And that cost is being covered because of changes in the ACA. So I know that there is a difference of opinion about the ACA. I just wanted to weigh in. It's something that's pretty near to me if you know people. I know people who do this work that they are seeing an increase in their business because of this crisis that's going on. But they're getting people well. And a lot of times those folks weren't being covered if they were in a stage if they couldn't stay on their parents' health insurance. So there's I guess we could pick it all apart and we could, half a dozen here and a half a dozen there. But every day you walk around, and every one of us I know, because this is not just an urban issue. It's not just a suburban issue. It's a rural issue. It's all across the state that we have this issue going on, and people are getting well because they're able to stay on their parents' insurance, and that's able to pay for their treatment. So, Ms. Chair, I just want to just throw that in if we're just kind of throwing everything in the potpourri of if it works, if it doesn't work, what's the good and the bad and the pros and the cons as we think about moving forward.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Lori?
And I guess mine will probably be mostly a comment, unless I'm wrong about this, but the manner in which you described using EMCHA in the pre-ACA world was a little surprising to me, because I don't think you could choose EMCHA because of price. You had to be first actually denied insurance on the individual market. That was a prerequisite of qualifying for insurance on EMCHA, was always my understanding. So, I mean, if, you know, brokers were somehow finding a way to put people on EMCHA, one of the other aspects of it that we just need to understand, and I actually do think that EMCHA was a really well-functioning system pre-ACA in Minnesota that did do a lot of good for individuals who were denied coverage, but it too was supported by a tax on carriers. So, I mean, we had an individual market that didn't accept these consumers, but then we taxed the individual market to subsidize the insurance products sold through EMCHA. So, I mean, in essence, we were creating a separate pool, but then subsidizing it with another tax to bring the premiums down to a cap of 125%, certainly from 101 to 125. But I was actually just kind of surprised also by your comment that people who had insurance available were choosing to buy EMCHA instead because of price. My understanding was that wasn't supposed to be the way it worked.
Yeah, a couple points. First of all, one reason in my area that you'd like to go on EMCHA is because it covered the Mayo Clinic, where a lot of them didn't. There were times when the Blues wouldn't cover Mayo Clinic and so forth. Now, if you have somebody that's paying $500 a month and somebody's paying $250 a month, the average is $375 a month. So if somebody's paying $500 a month and they can get EMCHA at $400 a month, they're going to do that. Way back in the day, many years ago, you had to have an application all filled out, sent in a letter of denial from the company. Over the last years, several years before the MNsure and so forth, all you had to do is have an agent say, my carrier would exclude something. And so you could look through their health history and you'd say, well, they're on this plan without pre-existing conditions, but they've developed diabetes. My company's not going to take that. I know that. The agent wrote a letter on their letterhead saying they're not acceptable and you could put them on EMCHA. That's the way that works. So, Senator Lori.
Mr. Brickwitty, help us with the little.
Do you wish to challenge the chair's knowledge on EMCHA? What was the maximum out-of-pocket, Mr. Brickwitty, on EMCHA?
Mr. Chairman, that question, I don't know the answer to.
$3,000. What's my record for the most consecutive questions? 37. I'm a chairman. It's my job. Okay. Senator Lori, you had a question?
I was going to ask
Mr. Brickwitty.
Peter, for some insights. I mean, I'm happy to be enlightened a little.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lori, far be it from me to challenge the chair's knowledge on anything, certainly having not worked in the industry anywhere near or having the experience or success the chairman has. I think I would defer to counsel for a definitive reading of Chapter 62E in either body. I think, broadly speaking, the chairman and you are both correct in that.
Good answer.
An enrollee, generally speaking, needed to receive a denial in the private market to obtain coverage or not have something covered in order to become an EMCHA enrollee. But I, again, would defer to someone with access to a statute book to perhaps read directly.
And again, that was the way it used to be, but in the several years following to where EMCHA was being taken off, we would just write a letter saying that they would not be covered by this, they would not be accepted by this carrier without a pre-existing condition, and we're off to the races. Council want to comment on that?
No.
We have good counsel, too. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you. This is great. I like having a chance to circle these things again, but I would, when we're talking about what was better before or now in relationship to EMCHA and other things, you know, when we were talking about the value systems that we have and that we care about the people, which I think is really true, But AMCHA, is, along with a number of other things, I also think was rooted in an interest in reducing the uncompensated care that hospitals were and clinics were having to consume because these people were not covered by insurance, would not go in and get maintenance care. For a person who has a pre-existing condition, we can't do prevention, but we can maintain health, which is less expensive than, you know, letting deterioration occur and then go for more expensive care. So AMCHA is rooted not only in believing we want people to have healthcare access, but it is to reduce the negative consequences, both in not seeking care early enough and the cost to the in the hospitals and in the clinics for their uncompensated care, which would simply be redistributed to everybody else who was paying and then goes into the cost of everybody else's health care. So this idea that with AMCHA being removed and we now deal with it through tax credits, and there is again another form of redistribution of the general costs, and that the healthier are paying for the less healthy, that as we do in many ways, those that have more pay for those that have less. And so the Affordable Care Act, I don't think, really can be seen, for me at least, through a lens of being chaotic or a terrible decision. It simply is a structuring and redistributing the costs so that those with, in this case, pre-existing conditions, could get access to health care. In the long run, helps us all because it reduces everybody's costs because we don't have them waiting around so long to get health care. So, you know, these concepts and these principles are what we're trying to achieve. And I was glad to hear people talk about that AMCHA was a uniquely Minnesota program. And of course, the Affordable Care Act was dealing with other states that did not have such programs, and they had systems paying for all sorts of costs indirectly that were not covered through programs like MNCHA. So, and I do like the idea that, you know, I have to remember that MNCHA was paid for by a tax on the insurance policy. That goes away with AMCHA. So there's a cost savings there that's offset by other cost increases. And I do think we can take a look at that as a source of revenue, that, along with the provider tax, that we may need to take a look at in order to resolve some issues that are emerging here around, you know, those platinum plans that are leaving the insurance exchange, that we may need to find a way to adjust the cost of the platinum issue. If the high-risk pool is going into the platinum plans, it's too ill a group of the platinum plans, then maybe we have to go back to AMCHA and see how that funding mechanism might help keep some of those products on the exchange.
And just thank you, Senator Sharon, for that. And just to be clear, AMCHA obviously was unique to Minnesota, but the Comprehensive Health Associations were, I think, in every state, because I was their speaker at a national conference in Portland, Oregon. They paid for everything. It was pretty cool. So I think every state, except maybe one or two, had a comprehensive health plan. But I think Minnesota might have been the first.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brickwitty, were we the first?
AMCHA was the nation's second oldest and largest high-risk pool. I don't think all 50 states or all plus territorial jurisdictions had a high-risk pool, but nearly all did.
Yeah. And that's because I put so many people on there while we were that high. So, okay, with that, if there's no other questions for members, Mr. Brickwitty, thank you. And if you'd please give Commissioner Rothman my best, I would certainly appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, I will pass that along. Thank you very much.
Item next, Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. I believe we have a Heidi Matheson here. And just to get a show of hands, are there others representing that group that are here? Well, I've always said when you have Heidi here, you don't need anybody else. I've always said that. Okay, so Ms. Matheson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
I am Heidi Matheson, and I am president of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. MNsure participation for brokers declined last year. And this year we are anticipating more interest from agents and brokers in becoming certified, due to the increased likelihood of consumers qualifying for tax credits caused by this year's sharp increase in premiums. The good news is that, the bad news is that the premiums continue to rise. The good news, some might think, is that more consumers are going to qualify for taxpayer help in paying for their health insurance.
This rise in premium means that more help is needed for enrollment. Agents and brokers want to be there to help consumers, but we don't have all the tools that we need. Last session, the legislature required the state to apply for a waiver so that consumers can apply directly with the health plans and still get their advanced premium tax credit. This would immensely speed up the process of enrolling. And when enrolling consumers directly with the health plans, the agents and brokers are able to track the progress of enrollment and communicate the status to customers using the tools that have been available to agents for years. It provides peace of mind to the consumers when they can talk to their broker and be told that the health plan has their enrollment, it is being processed, the coverage is effective, and at the very end of that process, give them their policy number. And this entire process typically takes only 1 to 2 days when working directly with a health plan. With MinSure, it doesn't work that way. Brokers are unable to track the progress of enrollment. They are unable to verify any information. They do not know whether an enrollment is in process. They do not know when there is any missing information or documentation. They do not know when the information is transferred to the health plan, and they do not know if or when an enrollment is complete. The only way to obtain any information is by phone, often during busy times with extremely long wait times, and often ending those calls without the information or resolution. And this will be during a very compressed 45-day open enrollment period so that consumers can get coverage for January 1st while brokers try to work with several hundred customers. The Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters has been asking for the broker portal for the last 3 years. We know that it is coming, but this year it's going to come to less than 5% of our community. Unfortunately, we are going to go through our third open enrollment season without one. The portal that MinSure is giving to the limited number of brokers will not meet the demand. Most brokers will, again, go through an open enrollment season without the tools that we need. When you combine the absence of the portal, the lack of progress on the APTC waiver, the sharp increase in premiums, which will greatly increase the eligibility for tax credits, you, again, have a perfect storm that will make for another poor consumer experience. And then, just because of the conversation that's been occurring, I would like to add to my comments. First, about merging risk pools. This would have a dramatic impact on the small employer market. What hasn't been talked about are the risk programs that end next year. The risk corridor and the reinsurance programs from the federal government go away at the end of next year. And I think that will greatly increase premiums for individual consumers again next year. If we merge the risk pools, that is going to be shared then by the small employer market. And the net effect to the small employers, some of them had great increases in 2014. By the end of that 3 or 4 year period, by 2017, some of them will have seen their premiums triple. We also have been talking about the MSHA population, and I concur. Agents were able to just check a box that somebody had a condition that they knew would cause declination from one of the health plans, and that was all that was needed to enroll in MSHA. But MSHA was funded by a tax on the employer market. So it wasn't shared by the individual market. It was strictly the employer market that funded MSHA. And this is a high utilization, high risk pool population. And it was a system that worked. The people that had MSHA were very grateful to have it, and they were very happy with their coverage. That's the conclusion of my remarks.
Thank you very much. And for the record, is it Matson or Matheson?
It's M-A-T-H-S-O-N.
Okay.
Pronounced Matheson.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Matheson? Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Item next, Minnesota Council of Health Plans. If you could please come forward, and then we'll go to MinSure, and then we will go watch Cubs reruns. Okay, Minnesota Council of Health Plans, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Catherine Kmit, and I'm from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to talk about MNSHR and the upcoming open enrollment process. The health plans have always made expanding access to health care for all Minnesotans a priority. And for the past 2 years of MNSHR, that has meant working behind the scenes to help people buy health insurance on their own. We all know there have been problems with MNSHR's IT system with how MNSHR's IT system was implemented. My member health plans have done everything they can to absorb the costs and headaches so that new enrollees didn't have to. We know that the IT problems have had a direct effect on timely access to care and have been the source of worry and confusion for Minnesotans, but we also know that we are all learning and hopefully making the process better. The health plans have been supportive partners with the state, working closely with staff from MNSHR, from MNIT, and DHS to fix the problems with MNSHR's back office functionality. This lack of functionality created problems for some people and made buying health insurance less timely and more difficult. For those people who were affected, these delays meant uncertainty of whether they were successfully enrolled or could access care. And in complex cases, the delays were even longer, and that wasn't good for anyone. Back in 2014, because of the technical problems, MNSHR was encouraging Minnesotans to buy directly from a health plan if they didn't qualify for a financial subsidy. But by last year, the front end of the MNSHR site had become more stable for people who wanted to use MNSHR. MNIT continues to work to build a solid IT foundation for MNSHR. They know they have to make the website easier for Minnesotans to use, and it's been a priority. This year, MNIT and MNSHR are making more improvements to make it easier for Minnesotans to compare and shop for coverage. These fixes are in the testing phase, and we don't yet know what will be fully operational by November 1st. I know you're going to hear from MNIT in a bit later, and they can provide you with some more details on this. This year, we continue to work with MNSHR in preparation for the 2016 open enrollment period, which runs from November 1st through January 31st of next year. As we approach the start of the open enrollment period, keep in mind that MNSHR is the only place Minnesotans can get help paying their premium. It's really MNSHR's greatest benefit. Fewer people qualified for financial help in the first 2 years of MNSHR, but for 2016, that will change. It is likely that more Minnesotans will be eligible for subsidies because the cost of coverage is more in line with expected expenses. We believe that we've weathered a difficult storm in the first 2 years of MNSHR operations. And the good news is that the uninsured rate has been lowered, and all Minnesotans have access to health insurance, either in the private market or through state public programs. There has been tremendous efforts by the staff at our health plans, at the county level, at MNSHR, and the state to make that happen. We are now in the third year of implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And we are seeing premiums that for the first time are based on the cost of actual expenses for the number of people paying premiums. Health plans, MNSHR, and the state have all had to adjust expectations throughout this period as we better understand the new health insurance landscape. Senator Lori was absolutely right. Health insurance premiums are so expensive because care is so expensive. And now, as we move forward, our key objective should be focusing on holding down rising health care costs and, by extension, health care premiums. With that, we look forward to working with you on future policy discussions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Ms. Kmit. Any questions from members for Ms. Kmit? Chair Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kmit, I asked Mr. Brickwitty the same question about costs going up. Are any of the costs from MNSHR specifically having to hire more people or, you know, whatever the IT costs directly related to or indirectly related to the higher premium cost increases?
Ms. Kmit?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, as you heard Peter Brickwitty state, that was not part of the overall rate increase request that was filed with the state. However, I can tell you that the health plans have set up, for lack of a better term, war rooms, if you will, where whole teams of people are devoted to helping to go through these enrollment files to verify their accuracy and make sure that they can get enrolled. I know that that's been the practice at probably all of the health plans for the past several years, but I don't know that it rose to the level of where it was actually causing a cost increase for purposes of filing their rates.
Thank you.
Ms. Schrappi. Okay, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Kmit. For years, we've talked about 834s and 820s. Can you just give us an update on testing where those two documents or those two transmission protocols are?
Ms. Kmit.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, I am not the expert in that area, and I know you're going to be hearing from the Minute staff shortly. My understanding is that the 834 enrollment process is in testing, and that is a good thing in testing for preparation for November 1st. I think for those of you who don't know, unfortunately, MNsure was not able to do any testing prior to the start of the open enrollment back in 2013, and it was, it became quite evident that the testing was really needed. So I understand that that's going on right now. We are hopeful, but I don't know the real status of whether that's going to be successful, and I'm sorry I don't have any information on the 820s.
And
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Kmit, one of the problems that we've had for the last several enrollment periods is MNsure will tell us everything's fine, and then I hear from somebody else, yeah, they didn't really ask our side of the story, and so I'm asking your side of the story. I think we're in a new era of leadership at MNsure. They're not going to try to pull the wool over our eyes, but because you're here before them, I wanted to give you the opportunity, if there's something we need to know, that you would tell us. And I have one more question, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the plans having war rooms. It's a special accommodation for the MNsure population. One of the other things that was done in the first enrollment period was you could, December 31st at 11:59, if you had paper in, you were going to get insurance cards and be covered. Are the plans making accommodations for that?
Ms. Kmit?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, my understanding is, yes, health plans will do everything possible to help people get enrolled in time. But what we need to have happen is for people to start shopping earlier and get enrolled earlier and not wait until the last minute. So I'm hoping that there will be greater public awareness of the value of shopping in order to see if they qualify for a subsidy, but also going through with the process of enrolling so that they can get their enrollment completed, so that they can get their insurance card and that sort of thing. Yes, it can happen, but it hasn't worked very well over the past several years if somebody waits very long.
Senator Benson?
Nothing further. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Sharon?
Oh, thank you. I don't really have a question. It's more a couple comments. One is I want to say through you to the members of your organization, and thank you for weathering the storm that you've been talking about. I have much that I will fight about with the insurance plans. I'm not promising to back away from that, but I wanted to say that in that struggle and fight, that I completely appreciate the amount of pain and difficulty and struggle that this has been for you and for your organization. So it's not that I do not understand or appreciate it. I simply believe that others may not believe that it's this changing that we're making is necessary and it is painful, but that does not necessarily make it wrong. And so my thanks to you for that. I also would want to say that I haven't really heard MNsure say that everything is fine. I've heard MNsure say that we are breaking out the multiple steps that have to take in order to move the platform forward for greater and greater efficiency, and we've had some successes. We have these things that we're working on now and things that are moving in the future. And so the things that have happened, we are always easily letting go when the pain is gone and focused on the most current pain. I understand that there's more pain to be had and more pain to be resolved. And again, I would say that's part of the transition and change that is difficult, but in order to achieve objectives has to occur. And I also appreciate you're highlighting the fact that we're beginning to see the actual costs of healthcare in the reflected in the premiums, and that is, I'm sort of paraphrasing, that the cost of the premiums is related to the actual bills that you've had to pay out, so the cost of care, and that just is another way of saying what I was trying to describe before, where we were using variety of mechanisms, MCHA being one, in order to offset hidden costs, those things that are uncompensated care, for example, that gets transferred over to somebody else's costs, and it's hidden. It's not understood to be an actual cost of care. So I appreciate your comments about that. I want to say again, thank you for hanging in there and fighting with us about how to proceed with this. And I continue to expect to have that fight, but I do appreciate I think that the health plans have made really an extraordinary effort in helping us all be successful. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, thank you for those comments. I really appreciate that, and I will take it back to my members. I would like to get to the point where we're all working in concert to address why health insurance premiums cost so much, and it's really the underlying cost of care, and we really need to focus on that, because until we address that, we're not going to make a lot of progress.
Hear, hear.
Senator Sharon?
Hear, hear. That's all I would say.
Just a thought I had is when somebody applies in the individual market directly through the carrier, Medica, the Blues, whoever, how long does that take versus how long it takes if you go through the same person, same plan through MNsure? What are kind of the timetables for just going right to the carrier versus going through MNsure?
Mr. Chairman, I think that somebody could be enrolled going directly through a health plan probably within 10 minutes, 15 minutes, maybe less. As far as how long the process is to go through MNsure, I don't know that. And, you know, they have been working to make some changes and some improvements. I think that going the front end, where the consumer-facing side of things, where the consumer is inputting their information, my understanding it's been faster than in previous years, but I think that's a question that's probably better answered by the MNsure staff when they come up.
Okay, and I guess the other thought was, how long does it take to get that insurance card? Because that's what folks are waiting for. The average health plan on an individual policy, how long till they get the packet that has their health card?
Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of looking to see if my health plans want to tell me, but I think it's probably pretty fast, you know, within a week or so.
Okay. We can follow up on that.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions for members? If not, we will go to item next, which is an update on IT situation preview, open enrollment period, MNsure minute in the Department of Human Services. Whoever would like to join us? If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Allison O'Toole, Interim CEO for MNsure.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson, Minute Services, CIO for DHS and MNsure.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson.
Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Human Services.
Welcome to the committee. Who would like to start?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for inviting me here today. As I said, I'm Allison O'Toole, the Interim CEO of MNsure. In the audience is also the MNsure Board Chair, Peter Benner. When I appeared before you in August, I told you that MNsure had a lot of work still to do, but that we're making progress. And today, I'm happy to say that together with DHS and Minute, We have made additional improvements and are optimistic about our third open enrollment period, which starts on November 1st in about 2 weeks. Some of the additional progress made, which Minute will explain in more detail in just a minute, includes increased functionality around public program renewals, 2016 shopping readiness, security enhancements, the 834 transactions to carriers, usability improvements, and the first phase of an assister portal. While our path has not been perfect, we've made real progress that Minnesotans will see during open enrollment. Speaking of open enrollment, perhaps this year more than ever, and as you've heard, it's more important that Minnesotans take a look at their health insurance options and shop through MinSure to find the best deal for them and their families. As you know, MinSure is the only place Minnesotans can take advantage of financial help, including federal tax credits, low-cost and no-cost plans, which can provide a real financial savings to the consumer. In fact, there are many cases where Minnesotans will be actually paying less per month next year than they're currently paying. In 2014 alone, Minnesotans saved more than $31 million in insurance premiums through these federal tax credits. That's real money and real savings for Minnesotans. And with premiums increasing, we hope and expect this number to grow. We've learned a number of important lessons over the last 2 years, and one of them is the importance and value of input from the people across the state who use, interact, and rely on MinSure to do their job, help people enroll, or find affordable coverage for themselves and their families. County representatives now serve on the MinSure IT Systems Executive Steering Committee. I also personally attend monthly county stakeholder meetings, and there's a dedicated portion of each of our board meetings for testimony from a county representative. These are frontline workers who interact with the MinSure IT system daily, and they've provided invaluable feedback in the last year. One big step forward we made 18 months ago was hiring directors of broker relations and navigator relations. These two individuals on the MinSure staff have helped bring these stakeholders into the tent by holding monthly stakeholder meetings, attending events in communities across the state, and representing their business interests internally, both at MinSure and oftentimes at other agencies. Mahu is here today, and they've been active and engaged partners with us for the last 18 months. MinSure leadership meets with Mahu leadership monthly, and we appreciate their critical eye as we continue to improve. We've relied and, quite frankly, leaned on the expertise of our health plan partners for many months now. I and many others at MinSure value their input and dedicate time biweekly to speaking with their leadership. You've heard at length about additional work our IT system placed on their operations in the early months. We continue to make improvements in processing enrollment, and I'm hopeful we will finally have a more efficient and timely process in place in the next 2 weeks before open enrollment starts. And again, Scott Peterson will talk more about that. Finally, our consumers. MinSure customers who have come to us for affordable, comprehensive coverage. In an effort to make the enrollment process easier for Minnesotans, we are also growing our in-person assister networks. In addition to our hundreds of navigators and brokers statewide, MinSure announced a partnership with 20 lead broker agencies across the state this summer. These broker enrollment centers will provide convenient walk-in enrollment assistance across the state. And I've recently had the privilege of visiting many of these sites in the last week or couple weeks, and they're all eager to get people covered. They're staffed up and ready to go, and we're so appreciative of these partnerships as well as our navigator partnerships across the state. As I said, we've learned many lessons, and we know Minnesotans need help with the decision to purchase health insurance. It's complicated. It's why we have a statewide reach with our navigators and brokers. It's why we also have a fully staffed contact center that's open 7 days a week, ready to help Minnesotans. Wait times last year averaged under 2 minutes, better than many Fortune 500 companies. And we expect it to be around there again this year. In closing, as I told you in August, my eyes are squarely focused on improving the consumer experience, managing and implementing a smart, balanced budget, and making sure as many people as possible take advantage of the products Minsure has to offer. As I said in the beginning, we have work ahead of us, but I'm happy that we continue to make progress. And I'd like to turn it to Scott Peterson for a minute to give the committee an update on our IT system.
Thank you, Ms. O'Toole. We'll go there in a second. I just have a question on one thing that you mentioned, and we'll probably go through the rest and then open it up for questions. But you said some people would be paying less. Now, I think there's about 300,000 individual people out there that have individual contracts. 250,000 of them go directly with the carriers, so they'll be paying more. So of the 50,000 that you're talking about, how many do you see paying more and how many do you see paying less?
Mr. Chair, this is, I think a version of this question was asked earlier to the Department of Commerce representative. I do not have specific data on that right now. We are looking into it, though, and I'm happy to report back to the committee when we get it. We don't have an analysis yet.
And I appreciate that, and I will follow up with you on that. But I guess when we're saying before the committee that some people will be paying less, that's very accurate, very true. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole lot of them will be paying a whole lot more. But I mean, what you said was accurate. I'm not questioning that. And I understand that if the cost goes up, there's more of a subsidy coming down, but there's a lot of folks who don't get the subsidy, and they're getting smoked. I'll follow up with you on that, and we'll talk more about that and get some numbers. Okay, well, Senator Lord.
Just to that point, Mr. Chair, you made an assumption that those 250,000 on the outside of Minsure would be paying more. They will be paying more, certainly, if they stay outside of Minsure, but many, many, many of them with the new benchmark after the rates were released will be subsidy eligible and could that weren't in previous years and could actually gain significant tax advantage by taking a new look at Minsure and coming in and getting that federal advanced premium tax credit.
Thank you, Senator Lori, and we will see how that goes, but that's a very good point, well taken. Okay, item next, Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just quickly on the from an IT perspective, we've continued to move forward with the delivery of the system as set forth by the working through the prioritization process, the stakeholder engagement, and redefining how we set the priorities for 2015. I want to spend, there was a successful delivery this weekend that some have mentioned around the assistor portal and other renewal functionality that went in, but I wanted to spend some time on those items that haven't been delivered yet, and the expectation is that they're delivered before 11-1. There's been discussion on the 834 here around that process, and we currently are in the seventh round of testing with the carriers. We've been working closely with them daily, providing data back to them as well as the transactions themselves so they can ensure that they can process them on their side. There's still work to do there yet. We have in the last meeting, actually yesterday afternoon, discussed with them additional testing that they would like to see around volume testing and the ability to make sure that they see the types of transactions comprehensively across the board when we go into open enrollment. The state team is currently working that now, developing those volume type tests to provide them data early next week. Another item that was on the delivery for this weekend is just open enrollment functionality in general. During testing, we had found some anomalies with what was happening post 11-1 using the time travel software we discussed previously at this committee. And so with the ability to move it forward, a lot of testing was done. Some issues were found related to post 11-1. The delivery of that code is expected to be this weekend. It's in the test environment today. Beyond that, there's been a lot of progress on back-end improvements from just monitoring of the application itself, CPU processing, understanding how the system works. The state is in the state staff are in a much better position this year with their understanding and knowledge, having an additional year under the belt as far as experience working within the system. From the state staff perspective, often we feel as if we're in open enrollment every day. The MA and Minnesota Care population uses the solution daily, so do the county workers. And so just working through that process with them and understanding behavior and how to commit to fixing issues as they raise. We've also committed to the war room starting in November 1st. We'll have staff actively engaged and working, mirroring the contact center hours to make sure that we're addressing issues as they arise.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Morocco, and then I think we'll open to questions for all three if that's acceptable. Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I will keep my opening remarks brief. In essence, what the counties experience, good and bad on MNsure, we experience. We being DHS, we are the 88th county. That's because the counties process MA and we process Minnesota Care. And oftentimes the functionality that's needed for those programs is identical or very similar. So much of what you heard from the counties, the pain points that they're experiencing, or to the extent that that is becoming lessened through things like streamlined life events, we experience those as well at DHS. So let me just cover maybe two areas, one relatively good, one relatively not so good. There's been a lot of talk about renewals. Generally, renewals, we are really at the final stages of being caught up on the renewal process. You heard about that from the counties. So we're talking about well over 200,000 renewals being processed in about a 3 to 4 month period of time. So from a renewals perspective, both on Minnesota Care and on the MA population, a lot of work has gone into to get us to where we are today, both from a technical perspective as well as just a sheer workforce perspective about between the counties and DHS, just going through a tremendous amount of processing to get us to where we are today. That's on the good news. On the bad news, I would say we still struggle on the premium side. Things are getting better, but we're not where we need to be, and we still have some work to do. Our first goal on the premium side is to get all the notices out. Things are better, and we think that we are nearly complete to identifying all the notices that need to be generated and out the door. As an example, two cycles ago, we were at about 50,000. Last month, when notices went out, we were up to 80,000. So we are relatively close to getting all the notices out. However, we're working very closely with Minute to identify whether or not we truly have all those out the door. Our second goal after we get all the notices out the door is we want to ensure that they are accurate and timely. Obviously, we are not at that point today, but we are very hopeful that we will be in the right spot come January. We can talk more about that, but we are going to be leveraging our existing MMIS system in order to get the notices out both timely and accurately. And lastly, once we accomplish those two tasks, we'll move on to the reconciliation process. I know from our prior discussion here at the LOC, there was a lot of concern about the premium notices and the fact that clients weren't receiving them, both from a client perspective as well from a state perspective. We understand that. And so, of course, the actual reconciliation of the premiums is a top priority for us, but again, we first need to ensure that those notices are being generated and are being sent out accurately and timely. So with that as kind of a couple of general comments from DHS, I will end my testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco and Mr. Peterson, Ms. O'Toole. What I'd like to do now is, if we could, is just open it up for questions that members may have. Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit of a disjointed question because I stepped out when Ms. Mattson was testifying, but Mr. Peterson, when we're talking about the portal, and I was here when she mentioned that she's going to, that we're going to be adding a lot more navigators because we're going to need more because more people will qualify for the tax credit. How's the portal going to work with that? I mean, if we're adding a lot more navigators, is it going to be seamless? Will there be, I don't know, expand on that if you could, please.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, so the functionality that went in this weekend on the assister side was essentially to give them the start of the functionality that they need. It's not a comprehensive solution by any means, and I wouldn't sell it as that. I know that the business has been working closely with the navigators and brokers to define that pilot project. As far as the testing of the solution itself as far as load and ability to handle it. The system, we do load tests for each release, each specific piece of functionality. It's currently testing very well. We don't see any issues from that perspective.
Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. So just for my simple little non-computing mind, if we have 100 navigators now or brokers and navigators and we're going to have 200, no problem with the system?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, no. Because to the system, it appears as if they're users of the system. They're acting on behalf of an individual. But to the system, it doesn't, to them, react any differently than a normal user would react.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, so is this, so when you're doing the testing or the system, there are 150 navigators or brokers or a combination of both that are using it? Is that my understanding?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, what we do is simulate the test, so we can simulate the number of users and then extrapolate on that.
Okay.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you. And I apologize if I miss it. And Mr. Chair, after these folks are done, would it be possible to get Ms. Mattson to come back and just ask her the same question about the brokers or the adding? Thank you.
Chair Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is just relating to the Minnesota Care billing and just some of those outstanding issues. I'm wondering, you know, I'm trying to remember some of the numbers that I've heard or seen in communications. So I'm just wondering how many Minnesota Care cases in aggregate have not received their invoices in 2015 to date?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Kerr and Representative Mack. So as I said two cycles ago, which would have been in the September billing, we sent out about 50,000 notices. On the last cycle that just went out about a week or two ago, we were at 80,000. So, you know, we're relatively close. We're working with Minute to identify exactly how many should be going out, and as simple as that might sound, it's a fairly complex question to ask because that functionality resides in multiple systems. So ensuring that all the systems are seeing and saying the same things is really kind of the key to identifying who ultimately needs to get a premium notice. But again, that said, we think we're relatively close, and by that I would throw out sort of an estimate like we're within 5,000-10,000, and I'm just basing that on how many lives about are in Minnesota Care. I mean, we generally float in the 100,000 to 10,000. When I talk about 80,000, I'm talking about cases. So rough translation is we're close, but I want the system to tell me that everyone who needs to get a premium is getting a premium.
Chair Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if I'm understanding correctly, if we're up to that 80,000 and there's the rough estimate is 5 or 10, I had heard 15, but we're a rough estimate, let's say it's 10,000 that still have not received their notices. Does that mean they have not yet received a single premium notice in 2015 up to date? They haven't gotten a single bill in the year 2015. Is that how I understand that?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, the reason for folks not getting a premium notice varies. There was a large section of folks that weren't getting their notice because they were in the renewal process. So, you know, if you recall when we talk about the renewals, we were to be renewing cases in January. The renewal process itself is what established the eligibility and the enrollment for 2015. Unless there was an enrollment, then there was no premium by which to calculate. And so the delay in the renewal thus delayed the notice going out. What we had anticipated is that once that renewal process was complete, the notices would then go out. That didn't happen. So that's why even though two notice cycles ago, we had most of our renewals done, only 50,000 went out. And that's when we then worked with Minute to say, okay, something is going on. Accounts are not getting created. Premiums are not going out. What's going on? We expected the renewals to initiate this. So so that's just one reason why some folks were not getting a premium notice. There are other reasons. I'm not sure. I don't recall the specifics. Scott may know, but so I'm not sure if that helps to answer your question or maybe.
Mr. Chair,
Mack.
I do appreciate that explanation. I guess the heart of my question was just understanding
if we say take that kind of middle number of 10,000 that maybe haven't got you, we don't think have gotten their notice yet. I'm just trying to understand, does that mean that those people have not seen a single bill in the year 2015 as of, you know, late October right now? Is that I'm just curious, or did they get one bill back in March and now they haven't seen one since then, or they have not seen a bill this year? That is how I understand it, and I'm wondering if I'm wrong.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I don't know that for certain, but I think that's a reasonable assumption. So,
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that then, does the department have any idea how much in total uncollected premiums is out there? If we were at 50,000, now we're at 80,000. That was a 30,000 gap from one period to the next. Have the 30,000 gap, have they caught up on all their premium payments that they missed for the first half of the year? If you are tracking with my question, does the department have a handle on how much outstanding uncollected premiums are out there? And is there a plan in place or being put together for how that gets mediated going forward for those folks and for the department? Because I would imagine it's in the millions that the department is short right now in uncollected premiums.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, no, I don't have a number on that. Again, we would need the premium to be generated in order to even know what a client would owe before we could then go and calculate what the unclaimed or unreceived premiums would be. So we certainly recognize that, this is an important question, I understand, for the legislature. It's an important question for DHS. So as I laid out, the first goal is to make sure that they all get out. The second goal is to ensure that they're all accurate and timely. So part of that accuracy component is that we can't calculate what somebody ultimately owes until we can get the accuracy correct. So we're very hopeful that these will happen in very short order. We are, with the premium notice itself, we're very hopeful that we will identify the remaining premium notices that need to go out by the time the next cycle hits, so that we can move on to that accuracy, so that we can then move on to that reconciliation process. So as soon as we're able to identify how what the value might be, we will certainly let you know. From a client perspective, we will certainly work with clients as we issue their past due premiums. There really have been sort of two or three key messages from us on this matter. One is that no one will lose coverage as a result of our failure to notify clients properly. And two, that we will work with clients once we reconcile what their the premium owes or premium arrears would be. So for those that this is a hardship, we will work with them to identify the best way to repay that back to the state.
Okay. And
Chair Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. Obviously, there's kind of the two sides of the coin here, you know, as lawmakers and representing in trying to manage the state budget, understanding. I'm wondering, is it fair to say that there's probably millions in outstanding unpaid fees to the department that the department does not have collected right now? Is that probably a fair estimate at this point?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, I think that's a fair statement.
Okay. And just
Chair Mack?
My other question is, understanding that MNsure is not going to be doing the billing for Minnesota Care, and we're going to be putting that back to MMIS, and I'm imagining that requires some updating. I'm wondering if there's a figure on how much is being spent to update MMIS and how is that being paid for?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I don't have those figures in front of me, but we can definitely get you the staff time that are allocated to that, which will give us the number that will be utilized to bring it back.
Chair Mack.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Lori, Senator Lori.
I was actually going to follow up a little bit on Representative Mack's line of questioning and say, a lot of these issues with billing for Minnesota Care premiums, which have, I've been very interested in as well. It has an effect on our HHS budget and the issues with this and the need to prioritize issues within the MNsure system. This one couldn't quite rise to the level where it was going to be addressed, and that's why the decision to move it over to MMIS for now, to go to that more stable system that can do the complete and consistent and accurate billing, and we're going to see that come online in January. So I just wanted to make sure that context was there, you know. And then also, I know we're going to have some more questions about the assister portal a little later on. And as I was digging through our packet, I was just going to let members know there is a piece from Minsure about what that rollout looks like. When you look at the when you look at just the dashboard, it's just three words or something to describe it. And we do have a little bit more detail that might help put a little context in. And then follow up, so finally, then to a question, follow up, we did hear from the Council of Health Plans how long it takes to complete an application outside the exchange and, you know, how long it would take to get a card and whatnot, but we didn't get much clarity in terms of what happens in that scenario for somebody going through Minsure. So while we have you here at the table, I thought Ms. O'Toole or Mr. Peterson, maybe one of you could take a stab at the other side that we weren't able to get from the council.
Ms. O'Toole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. I'm happy to try and answer that based on what we know now, but also happy to update the committee as we get when we start seeing higher traffic through the site in the coming weeks. But last year, consumers were enrolling with relative ease through the website, and that can, you know, it's different for every consumer. It can be 20 minutes, it can be 45 minutes, it can be more than that. So, but we were not seeing problems. I think Scott has mentioned that the system's running even better this year, so we expect that time to be less. But again, it's different for everyone. But we'll try and get a snapshot as people start using the system more in the coming weeks.
Senator. Okay, Representative Murphy E.
Question for Mr. Morocco. Mr. Morocco, I understand that I have a constituent that lives in the district I represent who was told that they did not qualify for Minnesota Care mistakenly and so purchased a QHP. And now the eligibility for Minnesota Care has been clarified, but this person is now being told that they have to purchase MinCare back to January and pay the premium. I'm wondering who at DHS can help me rectify that situation.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I can help you with that, so I will shoot you an email and ask for follow-up on that.
Representative Murphy E., did you hear that?
I did, Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco. I would appreciate that. I'm sure that's an error. Thank you.
Representative Murphy E. Okay, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had just one other question regarding the backlog of life event changes and how that's being handled. My understanding is that there was about 30,000 in the queue of unprocessed life changes waiting to get taken care of. If my notes are right from our last meeting, the goal stated at that meeting was November 1st to have that wrapped up life events taken care of. I'm wondering where that number's at and if the goal's been moved, when has it been moved to for those life events and those people waiting for those to be processed?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and to Representative Mack. So the goal is to have most of those changes in circumstances addressed as part of the 2016 renewal. So just to put some context around the timing and how the change in circumstance works, and also some clarification around the number. The change in circumstances were about 35,000 is what we had received and was unprocessed as of about a month ago. Since completing the renewals, maybe I should clarify there, much as the counties had talked about, it's a challenge to process a change in circumstance during someone's renewal period. And as a result of the renewals being significantly delayed, it also put a significant delay on our change in circumstance processing. So that's a long way of saying that the reason that there are 35,000 or were 35,000 is because we had to hold on to those until we could complete the renewals in 2015. Once we did that, we could then move on to the change in circumstance. But here's the challenge that lies there within. The renewals are for 2015 for Minnesota Care were completed relatively recently. We are also engaging in the 2016 renewal starting in 1 week.
So by that, I mean that we are now, sort of the good news, bad news here is that we are with renewals at the point where we are processing timely. That means that we are giving enrollees the full 45 days to enroll. We're taking care of, of the renewal itself during the renewal period. That's great from a system and a processing perspective, but it's not so great from a change in circumstance perspective, because it means, once again, we will have to hold on to those changes in circumstance. Coming back perhaps to a positive viewpoint on that is that the renewal process will, in essence, re-verify someone's eligibility. It will re-verify their household size, income, and it will redetermine their eligibility in Minnesota Care, or move them to MA, or move them to a QHP, whatever the case might be. So by far and large, while we're unable to process some of the existing changes in circumstance, they will be taken care of as part of the 2016 renewal.
And Mr. Chair.
Chair Mack.
Maybe this is for the minute folks, but it seems a little counterintuitive, and I don't know, it might be too hard to explain here and can follow up later, but it seems like at the time that you're renewing somebody would be a perfect time to put in any new information that might change their information, their status, and at that point you would catch, depending on what their change in life circumstance might be, whether or not they're eligible or they haven't been before and now they would be. And so I guess it just seems counterintuitive that in the renewal process is the worst time to try to process a life change. Is there any light that you could shed on why that's the case? It doesn't seem to make sense that an explanation would just maybe help shed light on that.
Mr. Peterson or Mr. Morocco?
Maybe I can take the first stab at it, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. So really from a system perspective, it takes a snapshot. It's a point in time, and it says, this is what I believe to be relative to this person's eligibility. As we then work with the client, as we work with the federal hub, we're accessing data systems where we are trying to reevaluate their eligibility. Bringing in a change in circumstance, in essence, sort of changes that history by which all of the renewal was predicated on. So it's a very reasonable question. And I think viewpoint that you have that that is when you would want to manage or kind of incorporate the change in circumstance. That's what we're hoping to be able to do, but it probably would be more from like a worker perspective as opposed to an IT perspective, because I don't think the IT system, as sophisticated as it may be able to be, wouldn't be able to handle, history changing at the same time that, that it's trying to process the renewal. So it is what we would hope to do, and we're hopeful that the counties, would be able to do something similar on the MA side. We'll have to see how much of it we can do and how much we can't. It really depends on the change in circumstance as well. So if somebody, let's say, gives us a change in of income, well, at the time that we're doing the renewal, we are pinging the IRS and federal income sources. So, do we want to take the data source, or do we want to take an attestation from a client? I think we have some business decisions to make to say, well, if there's a conflict there, which one would override the other? Another change in circumstance could be, add a baby to an existing household. Maybe that's relevant to the renewal, maybe it's not. So I think we would really have to go through the various kind of changes in circumstance. One of the biggies for us is address. We want those address changes in as quickly as we can, because if we're sending renewal information out to the wrong address, we are going to, just by that very nature, have a bad renewal experience. The client is, and we're going to be unsuccessful getting them renewed. So it really would be sort of a change in circumstance by change in circumstance approach to how we might incorporate that as part of the renewal, or get the renewal done as quickly as we can and then quickly move it into the change in circumstance processing.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's helpful just in terms of the system's perspective to understand why that is complicated at this point. My last question, just in terms of, just so to create fair expectations. So if I hear what you're saying in terms of these 35,000 unprocessed life events, you're saying those won't be tackled in all likelihood until the 2016 renewals are finished. And if that's the case, then when do we expect those 2016 renewals to be done, at which point it would kick in that this backlog starts to get tackled, just to set accurate expectations?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and
and representatives. So there are some changes in circumstance. We have a few days left that we are quickly trying to get in. So we're prioritizing add a baby, address changes, you know, adding coverage, the things of that nature. In less than a week or so, then, yes, then the system is shut out. There are also some changes in circumstance in that 30,000 that aren't even necessary. Let's say if somebody failed to renew in the 2015 renewal process and they dropped coverage, we are probably sitting on a change in circumstance that doesn't need to be processed anymore. So of that 30,000, some will get processed within the week or so that we have left. And then to your point, yes, then the remaining either are unnecessary because the client is no longer in the program or, in essence, would be taken care of as part of the 2016 renewal. Again, we are doing timely renewals, so it would be in advance of January 1st, 2016.
Chair Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I brought Ms. Matheson back. I believe Chair Hoppe had a question. If the rest of you could stay, there's a couple more questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Matheson. I apologize. I had to step out to take a phone call, and sure. You were quick. We're talking about, and the thing I'm always been interested in is the brokers and how they're interacting with their, you know, current or new clients, how they're going to find people, the numbers, and I mean, if you could just sort of expound, and I apologize if I missed all this, how the brokers are doing with the system and if they're, you know, it's going to be okay when we add a lot more brokers because we're hopefully getting more people with tax credits.
Right.
Ms. Matheson.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative. We're expecting that there will be more brokers that will participate in getting certified through MNsure this year because of the increased likelihood of qualifying for tax credits. And that's why the broker portal has been such a concern for us. Just to give you a little bit of history, there were close to 3,000, I believe, brokers that were certified the first year of MNsure. It dropped down to about 1,000 last year. And we're expecting maybe about 1,300 this coming year. Only 50 of them are going to have access to that broker portal. So that means 1,250 are still going to be without any tools at all. And when you talk about, like, the process, you know, versus going direct to the carrier versus going through the MNsure process, when I work directly with a carrier, there's very little information required. It's just your name, your contact information, where you live, who's going to be covered on the plan, their identifying information like birth dates and Social Security numbers, and then checking a box of which plan you want and how you're going to pay for it. Versus going through the MNsure process where you have to go through all of the income qualification, not only for yourself but for all of your dependents. There's about two dozen other questions that kind of seem unrelated, like whether or not you've ever been a foster child and several other things that I'm sure there's a reason for. But it's a much longer process to go through that. And then once you do get to the end of that process, you don't know where it's at. There's no status check. There's no way to follow it through the process. You don't know if the 834 has been sent to the carrier. There's no way to follow up on it. And obviously, you know, there's issues with that when they're talking about setting up war rooms and things like that. So that's where it's been difficult for the brokers to work within the MNsure system.
Chairman Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, my last question, and I just prompted by something that Ms. Matheson said. A year ago or 2 years ago, I don't recall, we heard from somebody that brokers or maybe brokers and navigators, I don't recall, were being told to get the usernames and passwords of people that were their clients that they were trying to get onto the exchange. Is that still going on?
Ms. Matheson?
Not particularly. I mean, the most effective way to work with a client is to have them actually sitting there with you in the room. Okay. You know, either in their home or meeting them somewhere or having them in your office. Because otherwise, if you just get their username and password, there's no way to see the information that they've entered into the system.
Okay.
There's no going backwards, you know, to look at the information that's there.
Chair Hoppe.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members? I've got one point that was just brought up to me this morning, and this would be so. Thank you, Ms. Matheson.
Thank you.
Thank you. At the last meeting, MNsure said that they'd received a federal extension to spend planning grants and approval to spend on operations. And at that point, I'd requested documentation. I mean, that made me a little nervous because they were spending money or going to be spending money on something that I wasn't aware was approved to spend it on. And the talk was that there was, on the planning grants, there would be, you'd had some communication that would have approved that. And then this morning I get this letter from a copy of the letter that you, Ms. O'Toole, received from Congress saying that they're going to be investigating the spending. And so I guess we don't really have a whole lot for this today, but all of these questions have to be answered October 20th. My first question would be of 2015, will you be able to meet Congress's deadline on their request? Question one. Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And we did receive that letter. That is not a new, it's not a new matter in our minds, but we will, we're currently looking at that, analyzing it. We certainly hope to meet the deadline. It is a big request. So we'll obviously do our best, but let us look into it a little bit more.
And I respect that. The only thing I would ask that for members of this committee, if we could be included, since we're the oversight committee, if we could be included with your response and then their response back, because anytime I get letters from Congress, I get a little nervous.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to, we're happy to give you the information as well.
I would just really appreciate that because we just want to make sure that everything is working properly in that regard. Okay, so for Ms. O'Toole, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Morocco, questions from members. Senator Benson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And with regard to the request from Congress, I really don't care about all the paperwork they're asking for. I just want you to assure us that you're not spending grant money on operations.
Yes.
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair, we are, and Senator Benson, thank you for the question. We are spending money according to SSIO and CMS regulations. So we are spending it. We are in compliance, and we're happy to share with you the information that we provide Congress as well, so you can see all of that.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. O'Toole, could you please tell us what you're spending the money on? Because it's fine to say you're in compliance, but
yeah.
I still have the spreadsheet from last time with questions all over it, and I'm not seeing federal grant called out carry forward balance, but I don't know what's in that carry forward balance from 2015. So what IT infrastructure do we still need? What infrastructure do we still need that you're spending this money on?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think I'll ask Scott Peterson to help answer this for you.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we can provide you the complete breakdown of the IT budget, which will provide you all the details. But at a high level, there's IBM is still under contract. That's an item. There's staff augmentation. There's state staff. And there's high-level bucket items of the software, specifically around the environments themselves and the build-out of the environments. Build-out of the data warehouse is another one. The audit piece, which we talked about at length, I think, last time as well. In there, but we can provide you that complete breakdown and what's been spent, where it's at.
Okay.
Senator Benson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One question here for Mr. Peterson. We were given some information about defects by priority and that there's 1,004 defects, which I don't think is that bad because I certainly have a lot more than that. But there was two issues that concerned me here. One was blocker two. That sounds kind of serious. Is that serious or can we handle that one? Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, so those blockers that are on the chart that you received, and I want to say, too, that's a point-in-time snapshot of where we're at and those change quickly and rapidly daily. So the two blockers that are identified on there are direct related to that, the next release that goes in this weekend. There's two that were identified that have been corrected. They're in testing now. The release should be this weekend. Those will be cleared.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so with that, Chair Mack and then Chair Hoppe. Chair Mack.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I just had one other question, I think, for Mr. Morocco, and I think it's just a brief question, but just something that's transpired from the last session, wondering on the progress, and that is the SHOP waiver. I'm wondering if that has been submitted to CMS and when we would expect approval for that.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, so the shop waiver is something that we're working very closely with Minshew on. Obviously, you know, DHS is the Medicaid agency. We don't necessarily have, you know, we don't run the shop program itself, but we certainly have some expertise in working with the federal government. That said, no, we haven't submitted anything, and we wouldn't do that without reviewing that with the Legislative Oversight Commission. And in fact, the statute specifically requires us to do that. There isn't a specific timeline around that either, or at least there isn't one in statute. So we certainly recognize it's an important you know, policy piece for the legislature. It's just with all the things going on relative to contracting and renewals and, you know, and Minshew, we had expected to do to really address this sort of late, you know, 2015. But that's really about the current status at this point. The other maybe small consideration here as well is Mr. Brickwitty talked about his potential waiver as well. The legislation itself wasn't clear about whether there was an intent that these go hand in hand or not. But you know, so but to the extent that the state of Minnesota is working with the federal government, it would make some sense on at least on some level that, you know, we're coordinating. So it looks like maybe we're making one ask for two different things, or at least, like I said, in some ways, you know that we don't have two different parts of a state government really reaching out to the same federal government and kind of asking things differently or in different ways. So that's sort of the update, I guess.
Chair Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and I think it would be good, and maybe at the next LOC meeting, or to be in touch with both Commerce and DHS on what does make sense if it's a collaborated effort. But with, I'm sure, what will certainly become an onslaught of waiver requests from around the country moving forward, I think the sooner that Minnesota can move on this, we tend to be innovative in our ways of approaching things. So I know earlier was commented on concerns of there's not really a model out there to follow, but I'm confident that the folks in the department could put something out there that would serve Minnesotans well and give them the best product available. And so hope that maybe, you know, in the next couple of months, by the end of the year, as we're heading into 2016, that the legislature has something to look at, to point to, of how we're trying to be innovative and move forward for the best of Minnesotans when it comes to these waivers. So certainly look forward to following up and being in touch on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. One quick question here for Ms. O'Toole. Back to the letter from Congress investigating, asking questions and so forth on the spending of the planning grants and approval to spend on operations. I would really like to see the approval on how those grants were to be spent. So if we could maybe get together and take a look at that, I'd appreciate that. Chairman Hoppe.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Any other questions or thoughts?
Before Senator we Benson? Adjourn, Mr. Chair, I wanted to know when our next meeting is going to be, because we're going to go through open enrollment, and it's sort of been the habit that we have a meeting, then there's open enrollment, and we wait a really long time to get an update. So if Senator Lurie could give us some idea when the next meeting will be.
I don't have a lead on that just yet. We can talk offline. And
could we do something, say, the week of November 16th through the 20th?
We can talk about that.
Madam, or Senator Benson, that'll be up to Chair Lurie. And I appreciate what your question is here, is because, you know, I called this meeting for mid-October here basically to talk about rates. My big thing was rates and kind of get a handle on what's going on there. Now we're going into open enrollment. I hope we can have a meeting, you know, to oversee how things are going with enrollment. That's not my call, and I certainly defer to Chair Lurie on that. But this is kind of the big time, busy season where I think we need to be overseeing Minshew, and so we know exactly where we're at. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just think for the benefit of the public and for process in general, for example, it has been the practice the last two enrollment periods that things are going poorly. We start hearing from constituents. We start hearing from stakeholders. And there's no public place for us to get those resolved. And so I think it would be wise for us to be proactive, so that if, and I will give you credit, certainly you are
acknowledging that there are things that aren't going to be ready. However, with the rate increases that we've seen, there are going to be a mass of people moving through that were not anticipated. And if people who are impacted are not getting responded to by MNsure, it is our responsibility to make sure that there's a way for them to be heard. And so while the tone has changed at MNsure, I would still like to make sure that we are being very clear stakeholders get a place at the table. While they can still be, concerns tend to get swept under the rug by the time we get to January.
Senator Lori, any thoughts?
We can keep our eye on it. And
can we do something before Thanksgiving?
I'm not going to commit to a date.
So it's been the habit that we've put this off and put this off, and the worse it gets, the longer we go between meetings. And I don't think that's healthy. And we've gotten to a place where MNsure is trying to be transparent. And so, and I see today with the questions from Representative Mack, Senator Hoppe, and myself, the tone is different because we're working on governance. And so I think in what they've been very clear, they're not misleading us that this is going to knock it out of the park and everything's great. I don't think there's any concern that having a meeting before Thanksgiving, letting people tell us what the experience is. This is a new tone. I think it's a new opportunity for us to have stakeholders come forward in process, and I would like to see that happen.
Any other comments or thoughts for the good of the order? Anything else from Ms. O'Toole, Peterson, or Mr. Morocco?
None from me, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me? Who? Oh, Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy? Oh, nothing. Okay, I'm sorry. Senator Lori, any? Okay. With that, good government all the time. We are adjourned. And you can come get your glasses now.